is 5:30.
Enter your meeting ID followed by a count. Enter your participant ID followed by pound. Otherwise, just press pound to continue. You are in the meeting now. There are 5 participants in the meeting.
So, Kathy actually does something at her end.
Okay. How do you find live streaming on our website?
If you go to the county home page.
Yeah.
Can you mute yourself? Please, we're live on the meeting.
We're live in the meeting. March 17th, 2020. Tompkins County Legislature meeting. Call to order. Can you all please stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag. Thank you.
The little germ catchers actually come off. Thanks.
Roll call of members, and I am going to ask everyone to please be extra diligent about speaking into your microphone and speaking clearly. We have some members who are on the phone as well who are attending this meeting remotely, and so we also need you to do the same so we can hear you acknowledging your presence.
Glenn Morey.
Here.
Martha Robertson.
Here on the phone.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here, also on the phone.
Deborah Dawson.
Here, in person.
Henry Granison.
Another person here and in person.
Rich John.
Here.
Anna Kellis.
Here and in person.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Here in person.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Dave McKenna.
Here.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne.
Present.
14 members present.
Thank you. We all recognize that something different is happening today, so I want to make sure I acknowledge that for those who might just be tuning in, because we are also in response mode and trying to be responsible around the coronavirus issues in our community and nation world. As a matter of fact, we are allowing, based on the governor's orders as well, and suspension of the open meetings law, that an attendance at meetings that some of our colleagues are able to attend remotely. As a public, we will see more and more of this happening for not only our legislature meeting, but also for our committee meetings. So thank you all for being. These are different times, and in different times, we have to also take different measures. So thank you all for your patience as we go through this. Moving on with our agenda, we have a proclamation, which I will read very quickly. I do want to thank Legislator Martha Robertson for writing this proclamation. Whereas before the birth of our nation, American women of every race, class, and ethnic background have made historic contributions to the growth and strength of our nation in countless recorded and unrecorded ways. And whereas American women have served as early leaders in the forefront of every major progressive social change movement to create a more fair and just society for all, despite their treatment as second-class citizens and denial of the full rights and privileges that are available to male citizens of the United States. And whereas women fought to resist their inequality in this country, proclaiming the Declaration of Sentiments in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848 at the first Women's Rights Convention, some 70 years after the American Revolution had been fought to win freedom from tyranny, and whereas it would be 72 more years after the convention before American women achieved suffrage with the approval of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution passed by Congress on June 4, 1919 and ratified on August 18, 1920 by Tennessee, the last of the necessary 36 states to secure ratification, so that 1920 was the first year women could vote in a federal election. And whereas the 19th Amendment did not guarantee suffrage for all women, Native Americans gained the right to vote in some states in 1924 and in the final state, Utah, in 1962. Asian Pacific Islander Americans did not earn suffrage until 1952, and the voting rights of African Americans and Latinx Americans were not secured until passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And whereas this year, the Tompkins County Historical Commission will celebrate the rich history of the women's suffrage movement in Tompkins County by creating and installing commemorative building plaques to honor local individuals who played a key role in the women's suffrage movement, and whereas the women and their allies who are being honored are Juanita Breckinridge Bates, Lucy Hawley Calkins, Helen Brewster Owens, Carrie E. Bouton, Reverend Robert T. Jones, and Reverend Cyrus Heiser, all of Ithaca, and Libby Sweetland of Dryden. And whereas two Cornell graduates who were also important to the movement and may be recognized at Cornell were Harriet May Mills, class of 1879, and Isabel Howland, class of 1881. And whereas records show that there were also equal rights groups in Groton and Newfield, and whereas after the vote was finally won in 1920, women understood that the quest for their rights would be an ongoing struggle that was only advanced, not satisfied, by the vote. And we all follow in the footsteps of these resolute American suffragists. Now, therefore, I, Leslyn McBean Clairborn, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the month of March 2020 as Women's History Month in Tompkins County, and the Tompkins County Legislature hereby celebrates the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment and the brave women who fought to win suffrage rights for women, and commemorates that day in 1920 on which most American women earned their right to vote. Thank you, and thank you, Martha, and I will accept this proclamation on behalf of all the women who are today voting. Thank you very much. I want to... Actually, let me go. I didn't hear a request for executive session. Is there... I didn't hear anything from you, Jason. No, not tonight. We did receive some messages through electronic means from the public who wanted to share with us, which is what we ask our public to do, because our meetings now are not open for the public to be here in person, from Gary Ferguson, from John Guthridge, both encouraging us to vote in support of the resolution for the conference center. Were there any others? And we did receive comments from Robert Lynch from the town of Enfield as well.
Also, Deirdre Kurzweil from Sunny Days urging us to support the conference center.
Thank you. Were there any other comments received by any legislators? Do you like to acknowledge, Anne?
I would just like to mention that Robert Lynch was against.
This is Amanda.
Amanda, can you hold,
can
please?
I have you. One?
Amanda, I have you in queue. Can you hold?
Anne? Sure.
I just wanted to mention that Robert Lynch's email was against the conference center.
Thank you. Deborah?
I thought that we received an additional comment from someone on West Hill.
While you look for it, might I acknowledge Amanda?
Deborah, that was actually the person that I was thinking of as well, Stephen Engelman, who was writing to say, please don't support the conference center. Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. Anyone else received comments that you'd like to share from the public? No? All right. Thank you very much. Robert Lynch's comments. Robert is, like I said, from the town of Enfield. We've had municipal officials coming to speak with us, and we will record his comments as such from a municipal official. So thank you. We have a lot on our agenda tonight, and so I'm going to ask for legislators, do you have any burning things that you need to share on the privilege of the floor for legislators?
Leslie, I have something.
Martha, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I just want to briefly acknowledge the passing of Congressman Richard Hanna from Utica, but he represented parts of Tompkins County for a couple of years in 2010 and 11 or around there. He passed away on Sunday at age 69 from cancer, not the virus. And he was just a great friend to all of us, even though we only represented, we were just a piece of his district. He came directly to meet with us on a number of occasions. He was always so accessible and practical and friendly and responsive public servant, and we'll miss him.
Thank you, Martha, for that acknowledgement. I, too, remember meeting our Mr. Hanna when I first joined this legislature and realized what I considered him one of the finer gentlemen who was in politics. So thank you for that acknowledgement. Anyone else? So although not on our agenda about special...
Rich. Mike Lane. No, it was Mike Lane.
Oh. Oh, please go ahead. Rich.
Leslie, I know we have pressing business, and I just wanted to note in passing, because we're practicing social distancing and avoiding meetings, that with life going on, a real friend of mine, Jim Case, passed away. He was an athletic trainer at Cornell. He was way too young, just a wonderful man. He's got a wonderful family, and my heart goes out to him in that you can't have a real funeral. They're talking about a memorial service in May. But I just wanted to say how bad I feel for his family, and just to recognize what an asset to our community he was and what a good man.
Thank you for that. Thank you for acknowledging Jim, indeed. Mike Lane?
I just wanted to quickly say, and hopefully I can speak for the other legislators as well, but I have been so very proud of the response by our employees, our administrators, everyone associated with Tompkins County in the last couple of weeks in this difficult, difficult time. And I want to say thanks.
Hear, hear.
I just pulled up my lovely notes that I had written to say, to also acknowledge the incredible work that Jason, our county administrator, and Frank Krupa, our health commissioner, and Amy Hendricks, Samantha Hilson, Jeff Dunn, Jay Franklin, and so many others who I'm sure Jason will fill us in on, pulling together as, you know, an emergency and incident response team to deal with this issue of the COVID-19 in our community, which, as we sit here speaking, is changing moment by moment. And 24/7 operations, these folks have been on their feet doing whatever it takes to inform our community, to keep us informed, to make decisions that will be in the best interest of our community, paying attention to what's coming down from the state or the federal government, all of it happening in real time. So imagine a large group of people just assigned to all of these things and fielding questions after questions that are being fired at them from all angles. And so I, too, want to, on behalf of this entire body, the entire county, appreciate what you've been doing and to let you know that this legislature stands behind you in full support for whatever you need for us to do our best to contain this. I know that is a big word to use, and we probably wouldn't be able to. At this point, we are in initial response mode, and I know we haven't even begun to climb the hill yet, let alone trying to figure out coming off of the curve. But we will get there. We will, and I know with the expertise and the talent and the dedication of the staff we have working on this, that we will get there. So thank you. And as well, I want to say a big thanks to our community, because they have been our partners in this, not just the nonprofit organizations and all the businesses and agencies in this community, but just our regular community members who are practicing all of the precautions that have passed on by the health department, who are looking out for each other, who are holding each other accountable for practicing good behaviors so that we don't enhance the spread of this, you know, dreadful virus. So thanks to all of you staff, thanks to all of you legislators. I know it's been rough for all of us, and thanks to our community and other community partners for all of this. Today on All Things Equal on the radio, I heard one of our partners, my JR and I heard one of our partners, Dr. Louvelle Brown from the school district. Jared called it the quote of the day, and I had to agree. You know, Louvelle said, don't go to the store. Go to the store and buy food for your families. Don't go and buy for the 55 as if you have 55 families. In essence, please leave some for the people who live paycheck to paycheck, and when they get their paycheck at the end of the week, that's when they can go get some of it. And I know some people have been stocking up and hoarding, and we hope that you will share when our neighbors reach out asking for some assistance. So thank you, Lavelle, for that. We have to think of issues of equity when things like this happen. So I want to thank all of you. In terms of special presentation and legislative discussion, the big, of course, looming topic is the coronavirus, and we asked our Frank Krupa from our health department. I figure we should just talk about this right now. Have Frank and Jason share with us what has been going on, give us updates, answer some questions that we might have and the public might have. So, Frank, allow me invite you to join us at the table. And we'll hear from you.
I have to apologize, Leslin. You know, I was hoping Frank would have cleaned up before he came today. He looked a little ragged.
What, he's in a 24/7 operation?
He's doing great.
The last 2 weeks, did we give him a chance to?
You got to take that? All right. All right, I'm going to start. He's going to take a call. I apologize. Thank you.
Yeah, these things happen.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Leslin, for your kind words and the legislature's support. It has really meant the world to us. I'll second that. You know, the complexity of this event is something that is unprecedented, and unprecedented in the sense that there's no way to judge off of past experiences how to respond, per se. There's no way to predict the future based on past experiences. Unlike most emergencies, we have an end that we can see. For example, if it's a natural disaster, we usually can see on the radar, if we can see the storm pass, so to speak, and we can assess the damage and move forward. In this instance, we can't necessarily foresee what that future holds. It's hard to identify what the end is, and that's unnerving, and it creates anxiousness and, to a certain extent, panic. One thing we were discussing, and it seems like old news now. It might have been Monday. Last Monday, when we were preparing for the first press conference in which we had Dr. Stallone, Frank, and myself. We talked about risk and what does it mean to be low risk, and risk is really determined on how prepared you are for the unknown or for what is to come. And our goal here is to minimize the risk, meaning we are more than prepared, or we are doing all we can to be prepared for what the future holds. Some of the challenge with this event is that you don't know where that direction is going to go, and that is what creates such a complex and moving target, so to speak. I will speak to the staff involved. Frank and the public health team, particularly the public health nurses, have been involved since mid-January. In terms of a lot of folks coming back from international travel, they have started the quarantine process, the monitoring. That quickly evolved over 4 or 5 weeks, at what point then my office started to get a little bit more involved in bringing in the whole preparation perspective from a countywide response. And really from last week, or the week before, we started to mobilize internally and started to take a series of staff. You mentioned some of the names of the staff. We are probably up to about 15 to 20 staff that have been taken out of their normal positions and have been permanently located into the Emergency Operations Center. We've set up an incident command system. Amy Hendricks is acting as our incident commander right now, and she's doing a wonderful job with Frank, Jay, Jess Verfus, as well as Drew Brayman as section chiefs in a variety of different roles. And there is, like I said, at least a dozen more, if not 15 more staff that now report to the EOC for their daily work. Some folks are working 12-hour shifts. Some are working a little bit less. Now we're starting to rotate people in and out. So it is evolving still. And I think you brought up a good point, Leslin. We are in the infancy stages of this response. We are in the early stages of it. We are not midway through. We are not towards the end. So I suspect and expect that in the near future we'll have more staff being added to that as we start to rotate staff through. The response has been exceptional. And it's been moving, to be honest with you. The staff that have stepped up to say, I'm willing to participate, I'm willing to help, working in areas that they're not familiar with, participating on a team, and just coming to work prepared to know that they don't know what we're going to face every hour, and sometimes every 15 minutes it changes. That's how quick this evolves. They're remarkable, they're resilient, they're looking out for each other, they're talking to each other. You know, the other day Frank mentioned, you know, we stopped as the governor had a press conference and we were eating our lunch, and the press conference was over and everybody just got up and went to work. Nobody said anything, nobody did anything, we were done, We got up, we went to work, and they were there for each other. And I'll talk a little bit after Frank goes through the public health element, because I think that's really what people have questions about. I'll talk a little bit about the preparation we have made on the government operational side of things, which any government over the course of the past 24 hours has had to prepare for and implement. But the response from the staff has been phenomenal. The response from our community partners has been exceptional. And one particular I do want to give a special note to is the leadership team and the staff at CMC has been wonderful. Dr. Stallone, Dr. Evelyn, the staff on the ground, they are truly high-level thinkers and have really gone, in my mind, have really brought a sense of strategy that I tell you, when I was on the phone call today with NYSAC and I explained to them what we were doing here, NYSAC complimented us because it was pretty much one of the only communities in the state that are doing what we're doing here in Tompkins County, and that's because of some of the high-level thinkers you have and the community partners you have. And they've all been there. So in terms of preparedness, I think our risk still remains low because we are prepared to handle it. And we continue to prepare and to continue to plan. So it's been an interesting past 2 weeks for me particularly. It's been even longer for Frank, so we'll give him a little bit of break that he's not clean shaven, doesn't have a tie on, but for the most part it has been it's been unnerving, unsettling, but also you couldn't be prouder from a group of people that we work with, and I mean that. But I'll let Frank, why don't you get into giving a little bit of a debrief of where we are with things, and then we'd be happy to answer questions, and if you want afterwards I can get into the operational side of things from the county operations.
Sure. Thanks, Jason. I think I have to start with some of the similar sentiments of Jason. The teamwork that has occurred over the last, I guess it's almost 8 weeks now, has been nothing short of phenomenal. I couldn't even have imagined that folks would be so willing to step in and help when they were called upon. Just an example, we were working over the weekend, this past weekend, and on Saturday it was clear that our community health nurses were at their maximum, and I made a call at about 6:30 p.m. to the division director for our children with special care needs and said, I need you to call your nurses and have them here tomorrow morning at 8:30. And 8:30, we doubled our nursing capacity at the department. They all showed up, no questions asked, just ready to do what was necessary. So it's just one example of what's been happening on a regular basis as we've called upon folks. I absolutely have to commend Jason and his approach to this. We've been making difficult decisions with very short notice, with less than perfect information as we've navigated this. And his leadership of bringing in the right resources, allowing competent people to do the work that they need to do, and then being a part of the difficult decisions to help guide our response has been nothing short of exemplary. And you all should be very proud of the person that you have helming the county. We wouldn't be where we are today without his leadership. So the disease, I don't even really know where to start or what to tell you. I'll do a little bit, and then you guys can, I guess, ask questions if that's probably the easiest way to go about this. But we've obviously been dealing with this since the end of January when we were monitoring travelers returning. I think one of the reasons we're farther ahead than other counties is because we have so much international travel. We were dealing with quarantines and persons under investigation back in the beginning of February. There are counties around us that have no cases and three people in quarantine right now, today, 8 weeks later. So our situation is different because our community is different. And so we've navigated through that for the first few weeks internally to the department. Obviously, as things have evolved and the disease has shifted here to the U.S., the transition has been to tracking folks that are ill. And there are a lot of ill people, not necessarily related to COVID-19. We're in the middle of one of our worst flu seasons ever. So that complicated things, you know, as well in the beginning of this. But we've been tracking the disease. We have had many folks that are symptomatic that have needed to be isolated. So we've been tracking that now. And of course, we have the three cases, and that really amplifies the work that we do from a communicable disease perspective. So just to kind of talk through what that means, when we find somebody that's symptomatic, we put them in isolation. I think I've had the quarantine and isolation conversation with you guys, right? We quarantine the healthy, we isolate the sick. So when we have someone that's symptomatic, we isolate them to limit any future exposure. We take a sample from them and we send it off to the lab, and they remain in isolation until we get those results back. So the good news is that when we do get a positive case, the person's already in isolation, right? So we've already separated them from folks. So when we get that positive case, we go back. We've already collected a lot of information from the individual, but we go back to them. We look at the onset of symptoms, and we go back 2 days before that. And we pretty much investigate the entirety of their life during that time period and everyone and anyone that they might have come in contact with to determine if they were a close enough contact that there's a potential exposure route there. If they are a close contact, we then reach out to those people. If they are a close contact and we're concerned about them, we put them in mandatory quarantine now. And so those individuals, even though they're asymptomatic, are now required to stay home as well. And we do that, and that's the work that we do to stop the spread of the disease when we have a known case. And I know there's a lot of questions about how much information we're sharing about the cases and some consternation, quite frankly, from our community. But we don't share that information for a couple of reasons. The first is, quite frankly, someone that's sick has a right to privacy about that. And I know folks say, well, if you just tell us you're related to Ithaca College or Cornell, that doesn't narrow it down. It does, right? It narrows it down pretty significantly. In this age of social media, it doesn't take long for people to start to put two and two together. And we've already seen there was a situation in Owego where the case was identified, where there were people outside the person's house yelling at them. They were making harassing calls, and the sheriff had to be called, right? So it's challenging, and we want to avoid that. And quite frankly, sharing that additional information doesn't change what the general community should do, right? We've already told folks, stay home if you're sick, cover your coughs and sneezes, wash your hands often. And now we've put in significantly more measures by closing the schools and the other things that the governor has undertaken to try to prevent folks from coming into contact with others. So knowing that general information doesn't really change what we would ask our community to do. I know I've heard some questions about what Erie County is doing. And one of the components with Erie County is that they're overwhelmed, right? Their numbers have exceeded the capacity of their nurses to do their contact investigation. So they're giving general information to the public because they can't do that specific contact investigation to the level that we would want to as public health professionals. That time may come for us as well. We're not there yet. Right. What I would tell you is that if we had a situation where we had a case and say they went to a party off in the city of Ithaca, for example, and we didn't know who was at the party, so there was no way for us to get that contact information through the individual. We would tell the community, look, we have a potential exposure route. This is where it happened. If you were at this place between this time, you should contact the health department because we want to talk to you about potential exposure, right? So that may happen, right? It's happened before with other communicable diseases. This is what we do. We do it all the time for things like tuberculosis and measles. It's generally not this public, right, obviously, but it is what we do, and there's reasons that there are reasons why we do what we do. It's not because we're trying to withhold information from people. If we felt like it was going to change our direction to the community because of a new piece of information, we would share that, and we would offer our recommendations on what people should do to keep themselves healthy. So that's where we are today. You may have seen right before we got here, we did announce a third case. So we're beginning the contact investigation today on that, and we're moving forward with contacting the individuals that might have been exposed to that individual case. So that's where we are right now. Obviously, there are significant community impacts that we're also addressing, things like food, right? Making sure people have food, students and others. I'm happy to report that the food bank, FoodNet, the school districts are all working in coordination to try to make sure that there are food available for the students and even look to expand that beyond to our communities at large. Childcare, we've convened the childcare providers multiple times, and today with the governor's new directive, we brought together TST BOCES, the hospital, as well as our childcare providers in the community to begin talking about how do we provide childcare for our essential people. The governor told school districts they need to come up with a plan. The hospitals have been given the freedom to create drop-in centers for their staff, and our child care agencies want to help our community. So we get those people together, we let them work out solutions, and they're going to give us a plan on how we're going to address this. Right? So that's how this is happening, and it's happening very quickly, but every time we're faced with a new challenge, we get the right people together, not in a room anymore, but on the phone, and we start working out solutions. And we don't have the answers to everything, and I'll gladly admit that I don't have the answers to everything, but I can commit that we are doing everything we can to address the challenges as they present themselves one by one.
Thank you, Frank. I'm sure there are lots of questions. Anne, I see your hand. Shauna?
One is just really short, just to make sure I heard right. It is the case, and I guess for the public, that child care facilities have been closed and that counties are urged to come up with plans for child care. Is that correct? That's what you said.
Yeah, today Jason issued an order to close licensed daycare centers. It's very particular. It includes the larger centers, most of which had all closed, except for a couple already, and they were down significant in numbers. But we have engaged those folks to help us find solutions for daycare for essential populations.
So not the smaller family, okay, group. And then my second question, Meals on Wheels, you talked about the different, like, food delivery support, making sure everybody has food. I'm curious how they are doing, if there's been an expansion in service support for them. Do they need any support for outreach? Has there been any issue with delivery? Because that elder population is the greatest risk, so...
Sure. We've been in close contact with FoodNet, and to date they're still operational, and we have given them the clear guidance that if they get to a point where they need anything, that they should reach out to us and we'll effort solutions with them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Shauna, then Deborah.
Sure. I actually spoke with Jessica today, and they were looking for volunteers to work tomorrow, the morning shift, 7 a.m. to 1 o'clock, I believe.
FoodNet?
That is FoodNet. And what they're doing right now is they're trying to package 14 days worth of food for emergency so that people can be set at least for the next 2 weeks. So that's one thing that they're doing. I do have a few questions. I was wondering what happens if people should be quarantined but people are not? And I guess there have been rumors around the county that kids that should have been quarantined are being seen on the commons, doing Snapchat, doing whatever kids do these days. Is there a number? Is it something that you would want to know about?
Yeah, so we have a significant number of people in quarantine. I don't have it in front of me. I think it's in the 80s now. We call them once a day to confirm that they are, I think we're texting and emailing too, but we're making contact once a day with those individuals to confirm their quarantine. Quite frankly, we need everyone to take personal responsibility and respect any quarantine or isolation orders that they receive. If there's someone out there not complying, certainly folks could report that to us. What our capacity is with quarantined individuals at this point probably isn't a lot. We would reinforce with them the need to maintain the quarantine. But remember, if they're quarantined, they are asymptomatic. So they are a lower risk to exposing other individuals.
Okay. Second, are the testing parameters changing?
Can you
mean
clarify?
The criteria
mm-hmm. for who's being tested? It's a really good question, Shauna. Thanks. Yes, in that we are trying to make testing more available. So let me clarify some things for why I paused when you asked that question, because there's some confusion. We don't do the test here in the county, right? The test itself does not happen here. That happens at certified laboratories, all of which for us are outside of Tompkins County. What does happen here is the sample collection, right? So a sample is collected and sent to a laboratory. There are criteria that the Department of Health, the New York State Department of Health, has implemented for testing criteria. And so we have been following those to date. You may have heard that Cayuga Health Systems has opened a small drive-through testing facility, a sampling facility, which allows them to redirect that traffic from the emergency room and the urgent care, so not to overwhelm them and to not bring sick people into those environments with others that might need care but might not be sick from a respiratory or COVID-19 perspective. It is important to note that that facility still requires the individuals to call their primary care provider. If they don't have a primary care provider, to call the urgent care and get an order from a doctor to go to the drive-through clinic, right? So that's really important. It's not for anyone that just feels like they're sick and wants to go get tested. We're not there yet. So it's really important that we don't overwhelm that facility and that people still call their doctor to get an order to go there. We are efforting larger solutions to make sampling in the community more widely available, but we're not quite there yet, but we're hoping that within the coming days, perhaps week, we'll have additional opportunities for folks that want to be sampled.
Thank you. And then my last question is for Jason. I know that some of the counties surrounding us are instituting a curfew.
Yes.
Do you foresee that happening in Tompkins County?
I don't think we're at that point. There would be a discussion that, you know, we would have to have with Frank about what the benefit of that would be. It would be also a safety discussion of enforceability. That's a difficult. That's another step in another phase of things. I think when you start getting into discussions like that, you look for the state to make a much larger decision. For the primary reason is, you know, we can do something like that in this county, but if, you know, there's no border at the line of Tompkins County, and it doesn't benefit in terms of if your adjacent counties aren't making the same decision. So this is one of those decisions where those issues where you look for guidance from the state to be able to make those decisions and give guidance on it. So we aren't at that point, I don't think, and that's a big step if we were to take that.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right, I have Deborah, Henry, Martha, Annie.
Thank you, Leslyn. And thank you, you know, Jason and Frank. I know I can tell because you guys look a little worn down that you're working very, very hard, and we do appreciate it. I have three questions for Frank and one for Jason, so I'll try to be quick. The first one is I tuned in on your town hall meeting on the radio the other night, and I can't remember if it was Frank or Jason. Somebody said we had 25 ICU beds and 15 respirators in Tompkins County. And I had mentioned this to someone, and they said, oh, that's wrong. They looked at a website that described the facilities at Cayuga Med, and it said that they had 8 ICU beds. So just out of curiosity, how many ICU beds do we have?
So here's where the problem comes in when folks ask us questions like that, right? There's nuance to the answer to that. And if you go back and listen, I think you'll hear that I said they have the ability to care for 25 critical patients, right? So there are multiple ways for the hospital to make spaces available to care for folks that need more extensive care. And we make those decisions based off of the need and the current capacity at the moment, right? Because the number of people in those beds is different today than it was yesterday, not because of COVID-19, but because of the other needs for those type of facilities. So we're trying to share the information as we know it. What I think is important for folks to understand about hospital capacity is that they are constantly monitoring what their readiness is to accept patients, and they are with us at the EOC, and if at any point there's concern about capacity, it becomes a community effort to figure out where we're going to get resources, whether it's sending them to another hospital, making decisions about patients that are in the hospital and how we might care for them differently to make room for critical patients. It evolves on a regular basis, and so it's important not to focus on the numbers because those numbers can be very specific and not necessarily reflective of the true situation.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, so my second question. With the protocol you were just describing, when somebody becomes symptomatic, you said that if the test result was positive, you then go back and you go over all of their contacts for the last 2 days?
2 days prior to the onset of symptoms.
Okay, so I'm a little confused by that simply because my understanding is that people are contagious even before they're symptomatic, and I'm trying to understand how long before they're symptomatic they are contagious, because if it's only 2 days, why are we quarantining people for 14?
Okay, that's a really good question. So the science is still being developed on how contagious people are prior to symptomology. What we do know for certain, as the symptoms are coughing, right, is one of the main symptoms. And if you're coughing, you are projecting out the infectious materials. And so you are much more likely to be infecting folks. How far previous, we are working as if they could potentially have been 2 days prior to the onset of symptoms, not isolation, right? Because they may have been symptomatic for a day before they reported to anybody that they were. So there's different numbers. The date that we isolate them is when we know they're symptomatic and they meet the criteria. The day that the time frame that we look at from an epi perspective is 2 days prior to the onset of symptoms. The issue with the 14 days is the incubation period, as we understand it in humans for COVID-19, is between 2 and 14 days. On average, it is 6. So we want to make sure from the point that somebody was potentially exposed to COVID-19 that we keep them away from other healthy people for 14 days. Because had they been exposed, we would expect them to become symptomatic within those 14 days.
Thank you. And then finally for you, I'm trying to understand how your party scenario is different from, you know, the incidence of confirmed cases in a large institutional setting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that somebody who's on campus or somebody who works for Cayuga Med has the same ability to infect people as somebody who went to a party. Mm-hmm. And so I do hope that going forward we'll figure out a way to balance the privacy interest with the interest of other people in those communities, because some people feel like we're playing it a little too close to the vest, and I think that establishing and keeping credibility and trust with our public is very, very important.
Sure. So I can talk to the difference between Ithaca College or Cornell and a party. Ithaca College and Cornell are big places. I could go on campus to either one of those places and probably not come within 15 feet of 99% of the people that are on campus. In a party setting that maybe is in a house, I am within 3 feet of almost everyone there during the time that I'm there. So the reason that it's different for the general population on campus is that once we know we have a case, we go to that individual and we find out where they have been. So had they been, say there was an event on campus and it was a small gathering, a happy hour. Let's use that for an example. There was some sort of happy hour that was held there where people were shaking hands and they were in close contact for extended periods of time. We would consider those people contacts and we would be reaching out to all of them. Just because you happen to be on campus does not mean that there was a route of exposure to a potential case. And so that is the difference in between a party and somebody that potentially was on campus or at a large institution.
Okay, thank you. And then finally for Jason, this morning we had an impromptu board meeting for the Soil and Water Conservation District to figure out how they were going to be complying with the governor's mandate that. And one of the things that was a factor in how we were going to set that up was that some of our employees have young kids.
Yes.
So now that, and in that context, it was mentioned that the county is providing an extra 2 weeks of paid leave.
Yes.
Okay. That'll get us through the end of March. But for people with small children, given that the schools and the daycare facilities are closed through April 13th, how do they deal with this problem?
Can you clarify which governor's order for the public?
Oh, the order that we cut our on-site staffing by 50%.
So, we developed the policy of providing 15 days of emergency leave for employees, and there's a series of criteria and elements to that. One of them being if they can't work from home and they have dependent care, and if those situations are the case, then they have access to this emergency leave. And the reason we did 15 days, and I should preface all this in that it was done to address the immediate issue with the expectation that probably by the end of this week we will start to evaluate as to what are the next steps. 15 days were selected because it is 3 weeks before school break. So that'll get folks to school break. Generally speaking, in a normal situation, if your kids are out on school break, you're either finding arrangements or you're using, benefit leave time. Understanding that when we put this out, we knew that we would be evaluating it again probably within the next 7 to 10 days.
Okay.
The governor also then passed, he was a little behind us, but, it was all right. He passed the mandatory sick leave for, I think it was 2 weeks of sick leave as well. That instance, that benefit policy that we put out, I think it was on Sunday, was intended to really just get us through this next stage, which is going to be evaluated by the end of this week.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
So, Henry, I have you next, but before you go, may I ask, Amanda, do you want to be in the queue for questions? Amanda?
Sure, yes.
All right, so I'll put you in the queue. Thank you. So it's Henry's turn and then Martha.
I have a question about the Ithaca College situation, in which the president said there was no increased generalized risk. And could you maybe just expand on that a little more?
Yeah, certainly the college can put out whatever information that they want related to information that they have. We've certainly partnered with them throughout this. I think generally what we're getting at there is that we haven't established community spread yet here from a case perspective. And so unless you are a direct contact of the case right now, we would still say the risk hasn't changed from where it was prior to that case.
So it's not like the New Rochelle situation.
No, no. New Rochelle was very specific in that they had a case that went to closed events a couple of times with large numbers of people in them. It's almost a worst-case scenario, right? So the reason that the actions that the governor took there made sense there and potentially not anywhere else is because it was very specific. And we could do that epidemiological work to understand who that person had been in contact with and know that it was large numbers of people, but that it wasn't all over the place, right? So it was still related to that index case. And so putting a circle around that and trying to stop the transmission from that circle of people made sense in that instance. But how this is likely to evolve in most other places is that you'll have one or two cases and you might establish that they got it through community spread. And if that's the case, it doesn't have the same benefit of trying to wrap around a small population because it is community spread and you don't know who could potentially be carrying or be exposed.
Thank you. Martha?
Hi, thank you all very much for this long-distance way of participating. Frank, I'm actually a little confused, and everything I see and hear says not just stay home if you're sick, or that if you're asymptomatic, you're lower risk for, I mean, it feels to me, everything I, you know, Dr. Fauci says, avoid all unnecessary social contact. Stay home. And you say we don't have community spread yet. It feels like flattening the curve really requires us to be ahead of the curve. And I think that I'm a little worried about a mixed message here. And maybe that's why some people are out and still not responding the way we would like. I guess I would, now, I did ask Jason earlier today, well, on email, what about going out on a trail, going out on bike riding outside? And he said, yes, that's fine. Just don't share equipment with anybody and stay, 6 feet or more away from people. But it seems to me if we're sending half our employees home, all these things are happening, it would really benefit everybody if we have as clear a message as possible, not just stay home if you're sick, but everybody stay home. What can you help me understand what we should be doing and saying?
Sure. Thanks, Martha. It's a good question and important to clarify. I think I said we haven't identified community spread yet. If I didn't say that, then I apologize. There's two components to this, right? There's the epidemiology component of case contact investigation when we know of a known exposure route. And that is different than the expectations that we are putting on our communities around flattening the curve, right? So the idea with flattening the curve is to use social distancing to limit the spread of the disease for as long as we can. Understanding that the disease will eventually be here as we know it is, we have three cases, that there are likely other unidentified cases out there, and that we want to slow down the spread for two reasons. One is to allow us time to study the disease further and understand how we can put public health interventions in place to lessen its severity, and also to avoid overwhelming our healthcare system. So we all see the drawing that's all over the television with the spike in the curve and then the flatter curve and that line that says healthcare capacity. So it's different things, right? Because we don't know the full extent of the disease in our community, it is extremely important for us to take steps to limit exposures to each other, right? But as far as an individual case is concerned and the epidemiology that's related to it, there's a very specific route that we take to do the contact investigation because we know that person has it. And so we can go back in their history and understand when they became symptomatic, go a couple of days before that, and then investigate their life and find out who they potentially exposed. So in that instant, we know who that case potentially could have exposed, and we can take steps to quarantine those individuals to protect it from spreading further. But as a larger community, because we don't know the extent of the disease in our community, we're asking people to take these steps to socially distance, to prevent it from spreading through unknown cases to us, to help make sure we don't overwhelm our healthcare system.
I understand that. I guess I'm concerned about a message that says stay home if you're sick, when aren't we all supposed to stay home, as you know, unless absolutely necessary to leave the home. For example, I just set up with two neighbors. We're going to share, you know, eventually we're going to run out of the things that are filling up the refrigerator at this point. Someone's going to have to make a run to the store. So the three of us are going to share lists, and one person will take three lists. And that cuts two shopping trips out of, you know, the social contact. So I think the public needs really clear messages, and I guess the idea of really, really don't be in touch, don't be around other people unless you absolutely have to. So I'm really happy to have the permission about having a legislature meeting and being doing it by phone. So can I just ask, I know Jason and I corresponded briefly about unemployment. I think one of the huge areas of anxiety is people losing jobs or being laid off. Do we yet have any advice for how people apply for unemployment? We do have safety nets that exist. People are probably not used to using them. So how do they go about that?
So right now, unemployment can be applied for online, and unemployment can be applied for through over the phone. I will tell you, as of earlier this afternoon, the state is experiencing overloads in both of those avenues. So they're encouraging folks to just be patient. But those are the two primary ways. You can do it online, or you can do it over the phone.
Okay. And what's the name of the where the state do they look up? State Department of Labor or what?
Yeah, we can push that information out. Yeah, I know it's on a press release we're going to be sending out tomorrow, the phone number and the website as well.
Okay, thanks a million. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you, Martha. Annie, then Rich.
Thank you. Let's see. So you said, Frank, Jason, that said that daycares are going to be closed, mm-hmm. and that's a county order?
License.
Yes. Yeah, licensed daycare
centers.
We issued an executive order today closing them effective midnight tonight.
Yeah. Midnight.
Just to be clear, it's very specific language. It's licensed daycare centers.
Not preschools.
Correct. The preschools fall under different. All this order covers is licensed daycare centers, which are the larger facilities. We're trying to limit the number of people coming together in groups. There is an exception that allows for the public health director to approve plans to support essential personnel and their children.
Okay, thank you. And then testing turnaround time, last I heard from, I'm not sure where, 24 to 48 hours, is that still current?
It depends on where the samples go. So the state laboratory, Wadsworth, the state public health laboratory, was turning samples around the next day. As private laboratories have come on board, those turnarounds have burdened up, they've become about 4 to 5 days. Some of that is because they're getting their systems up online. Some of it is because of the sheer volume that they're having to deal with. So it depends now on where the samples go. So it could be anywhere from 24 hours to 4 to 5 days. But it's important to know, particularly for the individual that is sick, that the advice that we give you when you're symptomatic is the same that we would give you when you become a case. It's we're gonna, as long as you can stay home and take care of the symptoms with over-the-counter interventions, that's what you need to do. If you get to the point where you feel like you need emergent care, then we would like you to call for access to emergent care. It doesn't change for the individual. What the testing allows for is the epidemiology side of it.
Well, right, but I'm just trying to field some questions. But sure. In some ways, it does. I will just want to add that in one way, at one aspect, it does change for them because they, you know, could be one day, it could be 5 days. So, you know, that does matter to them.
The length of testing, sure, absolutely.
The process of notifications is another question I've been getting. So, say I have a test that at the lab is positive. Mm-hmm. What is the procedure for notifying that person, and what is the procedure for notifying the state and the county?
So it depends on
time frame.
Sure, it depends on where the sample went. Generally, the first one to know is usually the healthcare provider that ordered the exam. Ordered the test, and we are always notifying. At least the health department, as well as our community healthcare partners, are always notifying the client before anyone else is notified. Right. So at any point where we've put out a press release about a case, we have already notified that individual that they came back positive. The challenge with...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand. Are you saying the health department or their health care provider notifies them?
It depends on who ordered the test, right?
That could vary. Okay.
Yeah, so now that private labs are available, they're not all the authorizations for testing are not coming through the health department. In the beginning of this, they all were, so we were getting notified. As the testing evolves, the providers will begin to be notified as well. And then we are notified either subsequently or simultaneously at the health department about a positive case.
From the lab,
okay. Correct. Yep.
And then when does the state, because just wondering, like the state is sometimes getting the information and sending that out, and then it's delayed, or it's a different time that we announce.
Yeah, so there are public health laws that require laboratories and or physicians to report to their local health department, or in some cases to the New York State Department of Health, positive tests. And in this instance, the state has required labs to report this to them as well. So when a positive occurs, depending on the situation, the lab could be notifying the person that ordered it, the local health department and the state health department, usually as close to simultaneously as possible. And then it's incumbent upon the local health department to work with the provider that ordered the test to make sure that the individual is notified. Sometimes they want to do it, the provider. Sometimes they want us to, because we have additional instructions and information for them.
And along with that, I imagine that there'll come a time, and maybe we've already reached that, where the county won't put out a press release every time there's a case. It might just be that people can go and check on the health department site.
Correct.
And just last thing, play dates. I've been seeing a lot of stuff like this on social media about people having play dates in people's homes or kids visiting each other, and then some other people putting on there you know, hashtag it's not a snow day, that your kids can all get together. So I just wanted to know if you could address that to the general public.
Sure. Yeah, it's a challenging question, right? Because we also have the child care situation that we have to address. And so we wouldn't want to make a blanket statement that two children should never be together. What we would want is for parents to take some personal and familial responsibility, one, making sure that they're not going around sick people, obviously, but two, making decisions about whether it makes sense to have people coming together, as Martha was talking about, trying to maintain that social distance whenever possible. But we recognize that people have to go to work, and you know there are other implications to this. And so I don't want to say that two children should never be together, but I would highly recommend that parents think about the potential of what not effectively social distancing can do for us as a community.
Sorry, I just thought of one more question. So for the seniors, senior population, who are seem to be at most at risk for injury to with this virus, I personally have struggled with this, and with my mother-in-law and her partner who are in their 80s, of trying to get them to allow me to buy them groceries. And because they're still going out a couple of times a week, going out to the store, and I've heard this repeated, the same type of thing in the community, that it's very hard, and often there people are getting the same reaction, whether it's their mother-in-law's parents or neighbor, like, that's what I usually do, and or I'm going at off times, and you know, and I'll be okay, I'm not talking to anybody, and. So I don't know if you'd like to address that.
Yeah, so I had that same conversation with my mother yesterday in her 70s and suffers from COPD and is on oxygen. And I was talking, she's like, oh, yeah, we're going to the grocery store and then we're going to go out and have breakfast after. I'm like, no, you're not. First of all, because the governor is shutting the restaurants down. But two, because I'm telling you that is not appropriate, right? You're in the vulnerable populations and you need to take extra precautions, right? This is a serious disease for people that are in those vulnerable populations. We keep hearing about, well, 80% of people are going to have mild symptoms and recover. Well, there's still 20% of our population that are at risk for some significant complications, and we don't want them exposed if possible. So ideas about having your children buy you groceries, you know, staying away from, don't go to church, right? I mean, those are hard things, particularly for my mother and, you know, her folks in her cohort, to have someone tell them they can't do those things. So we need to work with those populations, one, to convince them not to do it, and then two, figure out how to wrap around them the things that they need to make it possible for them to comply with those instructions. That's the harder part.
I did think of one idea that my partner said will probably work, is I'm going to just drop off groceries at their house, and they probably won't be the correct ones that they want, and they will flip out, and so then I will just leave a note and say, if this is not the correct food, please tell me the correct stuff to get for you.
Don't get them tofu.
Thank you, Annie. So I have Rich, Mike, Amanda. So let's move on. Okay.
Martha would also like to be on the list again.
I have Martha. Yes, I have her on the list.
My question
is, I have Rich, Mike, I have the list.
My question was answered. Frank, thanks for all your work on this.
Having been through quite a number of emergencies over the years, nothing like this, but as an elected official, one thing that comes to my mind is that listening to the reports out of Washington that the Congress is trying to put together a relief bill. Yeah. I even saw a figure like $800 billion.
Sure.
And when it comes time for the relief to come to our level, they're going to ask us for what did we spend? Mm-hmm. What has been our costs? And I'm wondering, are we working on that? I realize it's not the first priority, but if you don't keep track of it now, then you're running later and you miss a lot of it. It can be. I can't imagine all the things that the county government must be doing extra, from overtime to buying supplies and working with contractors and other kinds of things. But I just hope that we are keeping that in mind, that we might be able to get some relief later on, financial relief.
I can speak to that. That's a great question, Mike, and we have had that conversation, and we have made changes. I would expect by midweek or so, next few days, we have made changes to the accounting system so that it can easily be tracked for goods and services. Payroll is a little more challenging, so we have a system in place where there'll be, you know, everyone will be responsible for tracking their time related to this response. Right now, obviously, the EOC's got a good amount of time in there, and we'll be tracking that, and then that will put us in a good position to be able to, when this event is over, you know, how we'll submit that. That'll usually go through the state and then to the federal government. So we've, you know, as an organization, we have tracking mechanisms in place, and we've made changes to the financial system, and all of the other partner agencies as well will be responsible for tracking their own.
And the health department's had a COVID-19 code since the end of January.
Yep. There you go.
Yep. Glad to hear that. I wondered if, Jason, you put out information about the postponement of the village elections. Could you say that for the public?
Yes. Yeah. So the governor issued an executive order postponing the village elections to the April 28th, I believe, same day as the April 28th primary election.
They were supposed to vote tomorrow.
Yes, they were supposed to. There were four village elections. They were supposed to vote tomorrow. They have been postponed. I shared that with the BOE staff, as well as I spoke to Mayor Hart in Trumansburg. I sent it to another mayor, I think Mayor up in Dryden. And I know it worked after the BOE got it. I'm sure they circulated it to the village leadership as well. And obviously, assuming we have the primaries at April 28th, and they'll be at that time. If there is another executive order, then that would postpone to another date. But for right now, they've been postponed from tomorrow to April 28th.
And finally, I did put on my shamrock tie today, so I want to make sure we haven't postponed St. Patrick's Day. And I'd like to wish everyone as happy a St. Patrick's Day as you can have.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Amanda, you're on.
Great. Thank you, Leslin. I'm home recovering from a head cold, so I appreciate being able to call in and not be there and infect you all. Just Jason and Frank, thank you so much for everything you're doing, and all of your team. It's just amazing from where I sit, so thank you.
Thank you.
I guess my two questions are, is there any talk of closing like non-essential retail, you know, clothing stores, shoe stores, that kind of thing? And the second question is, how is this being handled in the shelter with homeless folks?
Sure. I can speak to both of them a little bit. Frank might make an also add. So the retail discussion or business venue, that would come, I've not heard anything along those lines, but that type of direction would come from the governor, similar to what was done with the bars and restaurants. To date, we have not heard that, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's not being discussed at higher levels. And it doesn't necessarily mean we would have forewarning. But that's nothing we've heard so far, at least not in our conversations. And we probably are in touch with the governor's office. Well, I am at least once, if not two or three times a day. The question about the shelter. So Kit and DSS and St. John's have, from the beginning, probably for the past several weeks, have had continual communications about what to do if someone has symptoms in the shelter, and they have protocols in place and to work with the public health department as to how they then, either if it's someone who's symptomatic, isolate them, and then where you go from there to ensure they have the ability to get, if needed, to get samples done to to have tests and then make sure that they're isolated from that point moving forward. And then also with the homeless population, our outreach folks continue to know what to do if someone becomes symptomatic, how we would then arrange to try to keep them isolated. As you know, that population sometimes is difficult to monitor just in general, let alone now. But our folks, our outreach folks, have that information, and they know that if they have someone that comes forward with symptoms, what we'll do and what process they'll take in place to ensure that they can get the medical attention they need, make sure they're tested if that's what need be, and then also make sure they have housing to stay isolated.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Anyone else who has not had a chance to speak has, before I give people a second bite of the apple. Dan.
Thank you. So I saw the memo about county personnel and what their options were, and talked a lot about emergency leave. Can you say more about what emergency leave is?
Well, it's something we created for this to be able to categorize it. Essentially, and I'm sorry, you know, I don't have it in front of me, and I wish I did. I could explain to you a little bit better. But essentially, it was created for the need of this response. So, and Frank, you can cue in any time if I'm leaving something out. But if someone needed to be quarantined, it covers the quarantine period. If someone has to be take care of dependent care, it covers that period. If it's someone who's dependent is quarantined, it can be covered for that period. So, if in this case, because we have to reduce the workforce, if they cannot work remotely, and their job function doesn't allow them to work remotely, and they're not in quarantine, not in isolation, it still covers that in that sense because they can't work remotely and they can't do their job that their title is for their job. So it covers, and then it also can be used intermittently. So let's say, for example, the amount of work to be done remotely is 4 hours a day, but the other 4 hours you can't do your work. This would then cover to make that day whole. So essentially, it's allowing for folks not to be penalized as a result of this pandemic. And again, it's only done for a three-week period of time at this point in time, only because that's what it would take us to get to the spring break for the students. And like I said, we'll be evaluating it in the next few days as to what is the next evolution of this. Frank, did I miss anything out of that?
No, I covered it. Okay. So it's full pay?
Yes.
And does it doesn't require that a person uses their other time first?
No, it does not. Unless that was intended. Like they had a scheduled vacation and they continue to go on that vacation time. This does not supplement it. It's also not a bank, meaning you don't get it and then a year later you still have it. It is used for the immediate moment. And if the individual was to say, well, I had a vacation scheduled next week and I'm still going to take it, you do not use it for that.
And just to be clear, if somebody says, I'm scared to go into work. I don't want to go into work. I'm afraid. I'm not sick. I'm a dependent. What happens in that case?
Well, let me start with the way we approach this is that there may be a very small group of our workforce that seeks to take advantage of the situation, or maybe in a small group similar to what you're saying. We can't address those in that instance. We address the vast majority of the workforce. And to be frank, the call to duty and the dedication to public service has been remarkable in this case. So in this type of situation, you're in an emergency situation, the minute and the very, 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 and I say very because I think it's a very small minority of individuals that may fit in that category, it is what it is. And we continue to move forward with the rest.
Yeah. Thank you. It sounds like a good policy, generous policy. I hope the employees appreciate it.
I think, you know, just to give you a little background to it, I have to give, you know, great credit to the folks that worked on it. As you know, Lisa Holmes has dabbled a little bit in HR recently. She was a big part of it. We had a good planning team with Frank, Jay Franklin, Katie Borgella, Bridget Nugent, Also, Lauren Cottrell from ITS played a big role. That was a good core group that really helped frame that over the weekend, literally, because we knew this was going to be coming. And Friday, we sat down with the union leadership. And I had Lisa and I had a good conversation with them. We said we're heading in this direction. At that time, I had not contemplated declaring a state of emergency. Unbeknownst to me, several hours after that meeting, and then it accelerated everything. But we sat down with the union leadership. We said, "This is where we think we're going. This is why we think we're going it. What do you think?" Got some great feedback. Got some real good reinforcement from them to say, "Yes, we think this is reasonable and fair. This is how we want to move on it." So I think we had good buy-in from that perspective. The group worked on it tirelessly from Friday evening, Saturday evening into Sunday to try to get something out. We had a conference call with department heads Sunday evening. I don't remember. It was around that time frame. The days blurred. So we got good feedback from them. We tried to get out to the workforce on time. I do have to also say that Cornell University gave us some great foundation to build from. We were able to connect with our colleagues at Cornell. They had obviously already had some thought into this. We were able to pull from that, and it was a really we really used that as some foundation work. And so the props have to go to Cornell for starting this work earlier. So,
thank you. Thank you, Dan. Anyone else who hadn't had a chance to speak who wants an opportunity before I go to Anna? Go ahead, Anna.
Thank you, Leslyn. Amanda asked part of my question about the homeless population, and I appreciate the information about the shelters. I was wondering what preparations we're doing with, say, the jungle and the communities of people who don't have access to any infrastructure at all. That's my first question. I have a couple questions.
I think Jason referenced that the folks, our outreach workers at DSS and other community organizations, are familiar with the people in the jungle and have clear guidance on how to address it.
I would also add that the emergency responders, primarily your EMS folks, if they were to get a call over there, they know how to, calls are all being dispatched with certain questions being asked, so they'll know going into a situation. If they're going into the jungle, they're going to know some symptoms that have been shown by the individual if it's called in. So EMS is aware on how to handle and how they would address moving forward if they had to transport someone.
Yeah, I was specifically thinking, there's no ability to wash hands, for example. Has there been any distribution of hand sanitizer, any kind of support that they can prevent or protect themselves?
Not at this time. Hand sanitizer is a premium right now.
And yes.
No, there has not been anything along those lines as of now.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate it. I've had a couple constituents ask me questions about the population of independent contractors. We talk a lot about how to, for people who have jobs and stay at home and work from home, for those people who are independent contractors who can't, like, people who clean houses or, et cetera, et cetera. Do we have any guidance, any infrastructure? Because they don't work, they don't get paid, they don't have a lot of the support systems that a lot of other groups do.
With respect to
as far as staying home, childcare support, finances, healthcare, any?
I don't have any specific guidance to private contractors. I think they still are, encouraged and definitely are pushed to continuing to keep the social distancing practices in place and good personal hygiene practices in place. But in terms of any specificity around those types of functions, nothing. No.
Yeah. I guess the last thing, we talk about social isolation. Of course, that's also in the health arena. That's the one thing that we don't necessarily want with respect to mental health issues. So I'm wondering, putting your other hat on, your mental health support, what you could share with the public right now who might be experiencing depression, anxiety, stress, what support systems we have in place for the public to hear.
Yeah, the first thing that we would offer is that, you know, crisis services will continue, and that's our priority. The suicide prevention and crisis line is available and will continue to operate. They can call our department and talk to folks there, but obviously this is rapidly evolving, and we moved from having a fully functional mental health department yesterday to tomorrow. It's going to be down to essential services only. So I would encourage folks to reach out to the phone numbers that are out there for the mental health department, the mental health association, the suicide prevention and crisis line. Those phone numbers will all still be staffed. And so that's really the best avenue at this point. And in the coming days and weeks, we'll be figuring out how we continue to provide the additional services that folks need in these unprecedented times.
Thank you.
And I hear you, Anna, and, you know, like Frank said, we're also under orders from the governor to reduce our staffing populations to bring things down. So, you know, the staff and the mental health is, you know, minimized. And so I want to reiterate what I said earlier about really encouraging neighbors. You know, Martha talked about, you know, a collection of neighbors who are going to support each other with grocery shopping, to call on each other, make that phone call, be a listening ear, just to help support someone throughout this. It is a stressful time. I also want to encourage employees to make use of EAP services, you know, and to reach out to any counselors in the community to think about it, about opening up services and allowing people to make a phone call to them as well. So we want to be, this is going to be a community effort, and so I really want to emphasize their part as well.
Thank you, Leslie. That was actually what I was thinking about. I would just encourage everyone, we don't make phone calls anymore, we text, but actually hearing someone on the other side of the line right now is it makes a huge difference. So I guess I would just urge everybody, make a phone call, choose one a night, call your parents, call your family, call your friends. Yep. I'll make sure they're okay.
Yep. That neighbor who you hadn't talked to in years, for whatever the reason was that you were arguing over the dog, might be a good time to now, because both of you might need support from each other. So please, let's do this together. Martha, you're on the line. Said you had another question.
Thank you very much.
All right, you're breaking up, Martha.
Hello?
And now you're gone. Martha, when you're back up, just butt in and I'll acknowledge you. Okay? Annie?
Hold on, I'm texting my neighbor about the dog and apologizing about yelling about their dog. This is a comment and then a question. So I'm assuming that, you know, I trust that if and expect that if there was any resources that the legislature needed to approve, like if you needed extra equipment or, you know, for your emergency operations or computers or anything for people to work at home, we're kind of ready for that if that, you know, if anything like that comes forward.
Well, in response to that, the declaration of the state of emergency grants me the authority
to do
certain purchases based on need.
Okay.
But yes, if there were a larger thing or certain things that were outside the span of the emergency need, mm-hmm. it would definitely come in front of you as quickly as possible.
Okay. And then I'm assuming you would let us know as soon as this happens, but I know the city of Ithaca, I believe, maybe yesterday closed their buildings to the public, and so I was just wondering, are we anticipating doing that?
Yes.
And or any certain buildings or departments, because we have a lot of ones that interface with the community.
Yes, and I can go over that after maybe the public health.
Okay.
If you have any more questions for Frank, I can go a little bit through the operations.
So Frank, before you go, let me just check our connection.
I would like to try again.
There you go.
Can
we can hear you. I was just about to call on you. Go ahead.
You got me, Martha?
Yes, you,
okay.
Martha.
Thanks so much. I switched phones. About the 50% of employees, Maybe I misunderstood. We're supposed to reduce our workforce overall, but if the mental health department, maybe not 50% of each department, but can we look at the whole scope of things and, you know, save the critical functions and reduce in other areas that can wait?
That's for Francis.
Yes, I can go over the workforce initiative in the right. If there's no more public health questions for Frank, although Frank, I'd like to just.
Okay, no. I guess I do have another health question. This is so. First off, the relationships that you guys are talking about, it's really a, you know, such a testament to the whole community. And I think 211 has been really critical in helping people to get information. So that's another piece. My question is for Frank: is what about nursing homes? And for example, once we have more tests, once tests become more available, do you have particular groups or populations, for example, nursing homes, where you might be more proactive in looking for in testing people?
So the nursing homes are closed to visitors now. The governor has made that decision. As far as testing, likely, but we still only want to test the sick, right? We don't test the healthy in any other health situation, and quite frankly, just because you test negative today doesn't mean you will be negative tomorrow, right? And so testing is designed for people that are sick so we can intervene in the spread of disease as well as provide them care related to that disease. So the idea of just testing everyone to see who's got it, quite frankly, is a waste of resources because it would change the next day. But back to your question, Martha, I strayed a little. But it does apply to nursing homes as well. What we're trying to do right now is protect that vulnerable population from outside influences. So if we don't let any visitors in the building and we screen staff when they come in the building and require them to wear a mask when they're around clients, it's a closed system. So as long as we don't allow the disease to get in, those individuals should be protected, and just randomly testing them really wouldn't provide us any additional information to guide our actions.
Oh, great. All right. Well, thank you so very much. Really appreciate that. And I was getting the other phone. You're taking off. You're going back up the hill, back to the EOC. Share, you know, our hugs and elbow bumps with everybody, and we thank you so much.
No hugs. That's coming from Anna.
A couple questions for Jason.
Okay.
Go ahead, Martha.
Okay. Jason, is there anything I can do about absentee? Could we, for the election, proactively print ballots and mail them so everybody has an absentee ballot? Or are we going to have to wait for the state to sort of make a choice like that?
The state is going to weigh in. That's the state going to weigh in on that. Yeah, that's not our choice. That's a decision the state will have to make a determination on.
Could we encourage people to ask for an absentee ballot? I mean, people could just do that. Right?
I think the rules around absentee ballots would have to be relaxed by the state to do that. I don't know that.
All right.
I can tell you it's a question I've brought up, and I know it's a question I've spoken with Steve and Elizabeth about, and it very possibly could come down to that, considering, you know, elections across the country right now are going on, and this is a difficult situation. So it's possible. I would imagine that the State Board of Elections has already contemplated this as an option, but as of today, we have not received any direction on that.
Okay, great, thanks. And sort of in line with what Leslin was saying, I know we can help. If there's a way, for example, I seem to remember that the Office for the Aging has had a friendly visitors program, people who just volunteers who signed up to go visit seniors who live alone, go on a weekly basis or whatever. If there's a network like that, if COFA has a list of seniors, you know, who get or would like to get that kind of interaction, I'm sure, speak for all of us here, we would help make those kinds of phone, not in person, make those phone calls. If there's anything, or if there's other kind of mass volunteer work that we could help organize.
Sure.
I know that's not first on your list right now. I'm just suggesting if there's, you know, if we could be part of another tier of this response, if you have any thoughts about that.
Sure. I can definitely bring it up to the team and put it in the bank of volunteer initiatives, and you know, I'll bring it up to the folks and let them stew on it.
Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else before I take a turn? I've been very quiet on this. Just because Jason bugs me 18 times a day.
Just real quick, since you mentioned volunteers, I saw that the governor now has a site where you can sign up to medical, retired medical people can sign up to volunteer, so they can have a volunteer bank.
Great.
So, because I know people had asked me for that, so I'm assuming then they'll give the information to you guys if you need it. So, right, so I'll just refer people to there.
That'd be great. Okay. Thank you.
So I have a couple of questions before Jason goes on a little bit more about operations, and these are for Frank. So Frank, if someone develops symptoms at, let's say, at my business establishment, and the person goes to their healthcare provider, what should I be doing with my other employees who are there? Should I be calling the health department now out of concern? What should I be doing?
So I would direct folks to our webpage. There's a lot of information there in the frequently asked questions. If someone is symptomatic and we isolate them, we do talk to them about their history, why they were symptomatic, and if there was a need to contact their employer or any other type of facility that they had been in, we would make those contacts and provide some additional guidance. But simply having symptoms doesn't necessarily mean you're going to become positive, and simply having someone in your building that had symptoms doesn't necessarily mean everyone in that building now is exposed. It does depend on the type of building, the size, the space, how close people are, how long the person was there, all of those types of things. And so we would want to talk that through with anyone that might have questions. But there's a lot of good information about cleaning that folks can do, and certainly, you know, we've been talking with people about quarantine for quite some time.
Thank you. So as you can imagine, I'm asking this question because people get into a panic. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, somebody has developed symptoms, or this is, you know, of concern. Other, you know, colleagues around might be concerned and want to know, what do? We shut it down? And so check the website. And if they feel differently, give a call and you'll help walk through the process with them. Thank you. Someone else, or a few other people contacted me and had, it was interesting because they said they were tested by their healthcare provider. They had upper respiratory stuff, all the things. And they're like, well, you know, I was tested and, you know, they just sent me home. And so the concern was they tested me for the virus and said I didn't have it. I didn't know what to tell them. Is that what's supposed to happen? Is there something different?
So I certainly wouldn't want to question anyone's truthfulness. But I will tell you that if anyone had been sampled, we would know about it. Those people that are in isolation that we're reporting on every day, those are all the people that have been sampled. And until even still now, now, there are only a few places that can safely collect those samples, which is why Cayuga Health Systems opened their drive-through to facilitate that. So individuals may have been tested for the flu. There is a rapid flu test that can happen. There are tests that can happen in a doctor's office, and they may have been told your tests were negative, but a COVID-19 test is not happening in the doctor's office.
Thank you. That's what I...
Yeah, and so at least you can't get the results in the doctor's office while you're waiting. It has to go to a laboratory. But because of the limited availability of testing in the early parts of this, and to a degree still now, the best advice still is to go home and isolate yourself and treat your symptoms. If you become sick enough that you need emergent care, then of course seek that. But again, as I think I said at some point here, when you test positive, our advice to you as an individual doesn't change. If you're symptomatic, whether it's the flu or COVID-19, you should go home, isolate yourself from others, including your family, and treat yourself with over-the-counter type interventions. And of course, if you get into an emergent situation, seek emergency care.
Thank you very much for that. Are there any other questions for Frank? I'm sure things will come up. I'm constantly on the phone with, Jason and others, and as information becomes available, try to share with you as quickly as I can, try to encourage Jason and Frank to share with you as quickly as they can, but asking everybody's understanding and patience of this is a large unknown from one moment to the next operation on what's going down, and they're doing their best, so they may not get back to you right away. But you'll hear something at some point. And if not, just give me a nudge. We'll try and make it happen. So please understand that they're working overtime. We're talking about how Deborah was talking about how they look. So they're working overtime and really hard for all of us. Jason.
Sure. Thank you, Leslin. So yesterday the governor put out a directive, which was later followed by an executive order for local governments to make an attempt to reduce your workforce by 50%. And the goal of that is to prioritize essential services and then also to try to remove the opportunity for person-to-person contact as much as possible. And the number 50% is what we're targeted to do. I can tell you some counties that have nursing homes and larger jails and larger sheriff's offices are not able to comply with this, but they're making every effort to. The planning team out of the EOC, which included the same group that worked on the leave, which is Jay Franklin, Lisa Holmes, Katie Borghella, Bridget Nugent, Lauren Cottrell, were the ones that really focused on this. And after. Of course, we find out about it as we're watching the press conference live. So after we get over the initial response to that, they jump into action. They set up a conference call with the department heads and started to give some direction for later that day. And what we decided to do late yesterday was make today a planning day and execution effective for Wednesday morning. And a lot of the department heads picked up. I got to say that they did jump right in. They understood what the direction was. They started to try to determine essential services and what can they reduce, and a lot of this is really down to cutting staff to bare bones presence in order to continue to provide service, but also rotating staff through. So if people can work remotely, they can work remotely, and maybe one person out of the team is in the office at a time if needed to provide services. So while the governor's target was 50%, we were able to reduce 60%. So we exceeded the target, and this, of course, will evolve from tomorrow and Thursday and Friday and every day as we go forward. But for the most part, I'll read off a few changes, and we're going to be putting out a press release tomorrow that's going to identify the notable changes. If I don't mention it, generally what is expected is that the department will probably still remain open for business, but will have significantly reduced staff, and we are encouraging all folks that when they come come to get services to call ahead, depending on those offices. So, for example, the DMV is going to be open from 8:30 to 12:30, and then after that it will be only appointment only. And they'll be working to reduce crowd control, and they're going to reduce their staff during that period of time. Health Department has some services suspended, and they have staffing shifts based on the current response. Highway, you have a most department heads will be working, but you have department head, the deputy. You have the garage mechanic and a mechanic available primarily to ensure that the public safety vehicles are maintained if there's any issues with public safety vehicles. You also have a supervisor coming in, and they'll be surveilling the road. So at this time of year, you're going to start to get pothole complaints. You might have dead animal requests, those types of things. So we also get the rainy season and wind season. So if we have an event or two, then we'll call staff in. And this is really just for the next 2 weeks. You'll call staff in as needed for that. For the most part, most of those folks will be home. Mental health has some. The clinic and the pros is providing services, limited services through the rest of the month. Most of their other meetings have been canceled. They're going to telecommunication or telephone communications with their clients. They're able to order reorder prescriptions over the phone. They're able to meet with their clients over the phone. This will evolve as well. As Frank said, the crisis team. I'm not saying it right, Frank. Crisis services are still online, but they're really minimizing all personal contact. Recycling materials and management is staying open for now because it's a transfer station for garbage. Garbage is, we got to make sure garbage continues to flow out of the community. So that'll stay open for now. There is some reduction in staff, and there's some reduction in public access as well. Obviously, Sheriff's Office continues to operate. Jail continues to operate. Dispatch continues to operate as is in the Dewar team. Social services, there's been a lot of, this is one of the most challenging departments. There's been a lot of relaxed regulations by the state, which are allowing most, if not all, of their services to be done over the phone. SNAP benefit renewals have been extended, Medicaid, those types of things. All those things now can happen over the phone where possible. So there's a lot of remote work opportunities, and as well as DSS, or the social services, has given some guidance. I'm sorry, New York State has given some guidances. All folks that come to the building will be screened prior to entry into the building. They'll be asked a series of questions that they worked over with the public health department about how they're feeling, travel, all those situations. If they do are showing symptoms or acknowledge symptoms, DSS will then work for them to be transported or find a method for them to get to a primary care provider or urgent care to be able to be seen by medical personnel to make a determination as to what are the next steps for them. Workforce New York actually closed because the Department of Labor shut it down. And we're going to push out some new information with unemployment. And most, if not everything else, a lot of remote services. So a lot of folks, if they had appointments, they can, if they would normally see people, they can now have those appointments over the phone, or they can work remotely with the cell phone and their laptop. Not everyone has a VPN, meaning they don't have access to get into the network because they don't need it. There's other services like SharePoint where documents can be shared and they can access that from a typical home internet access, but we're able to reduce actual presence to 40%. So that's a good effort on our part, I suspect this will be changing from tomorrow to Thursday to Friday as we start to realize, saying, you know what, there doesn't need to be any access for that, because folks are just recognizing that they're not coming out for a variety of reasons, or it's just not necessary to do it, and I suspect that we'll probably even lower that, make that number. We'll increase that number in terms of reduction in the next few days just as we start to go through a trial run of it. You really start to look at your services and seeing the different buildings and the challenges that can come from that, and what services are essential. So, like I said, we'll just evaluate it tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday, and we'll adjust accordingly.
Mike, then.
Wilson, I have a question.
I just wondered about the county clerk's office. Will that stay open?
County clerk, The county clerk, no, well, the courthouse is shut down.
So that's closed down because the whole courthouse
is shut down. Yeah, the county clerk is, yep. Yeah, DMV is on a morning only and then appointment only after that.
Thank you.
Anna, then Martha.
Can I have a question?
Yeah, I have you in the queue, Martha. Anna, then Martha.
So just to clarify, a few things that you said, the transfer station for garbage is going to be open. What, recycling, is that also?
That'll be open. I mean, okay. There's not a lot of interaction with folks over there, so it's a relative. I mean, your employees are in a booth. Folks are coming in out their free will. They've had apparently a lot of calls to assure they're open, and you know, refuse is important to make sure it continues to move on.
Great. And Workforce New York has been shut down completely for people with unemployment. That's
because
all call in.
Yeah, because they share an office with the Department of Labor, and it's actually the Department of Labor's mm-hmm. space that we rent from them. They shut that down 2 days ago.
But people can still access unemployment by online or phone.
Yes, I believe there's some new guidance now because of the amount of folks that have been applying. I think it's now broken down. There's some information coming out from the state that if your last name starts with a certain letter, it's on certain days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But we're going to get some clarity on that. We'll push it out.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
Martha, Dave, then Annie.
So you said the courthouse is closed. Does that mean the district attorney's office is closed entirely?
No. The district attorney's office is on a reduced staff. But the court is currently closed. So they're still working, but they're on a reduced staff.
So do we have any people who are incarcerated awaiting trial and trials are getting pushed out? Do we know?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. It sounds like, this makes sense, the typical highway construction season, the typical maintenance and repair and reconstruction schedule that we had is just all on hold. Is that right?
That is going to be, I think, a big point of discussion in the next few days. So right now we took action to get it out the door. I think the next step is now to evaluate. Right now a lot of stuff's going to bid or is out to bid. So what is the next evolution of this look like after next week is our next series of discussions.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right, Dave?
Yeah, Jason, the highway department, you said you've sent a portion of those people home. Are they being paid? How's that going to work for those people?
Yes, everybody's being paid.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Annie?
So I know this is a lot of changing information really fast. Is there a place where the public, the things that the public would use most often, is there a condensed or something in?
What we're asking is all the department heads, and they've already started to, they'll be pushing out changes on their webpage, on their social media. Some of them have Twitter, Facebook pages, so they'll be pushing out a lot of any of their changes out in those routes.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
And I imagine that the services that people use, they will look to those pages and and make those phone calls to the places where they use regularly.
Yes. I will just mention, this is gonna take a little bit of time to work through. So tomorrow we'll find out where some of the snags and the hiccups are, and we'll have to correct it. It'll take a few days to get going.
Any other questions for Jason?
I have one other thought. I keep thinking about people without internet. Could we, maybe when you settle the offices and the access to services, maybe put an ad or whatever in the journal, if anybody reads the journal anymore. But, really proactively publish in the Ithaca Times and the journal what the schedule is or where people can call for information.
We'll be pushing out a press release that will have a lot of that information. We'll also have it to 211. 211 will have the information.
Yep. So. Okay, great.
And 2-in-1 has been also 2-in-1's been great to work
awesome.
With. They're a huge resource and asset. So we will definitely tell.
They have been awesome. Anything else before we let Frank go back to what he was going to do? Yes, Henry.
Jason, are there any other operation things that are coming up that you know about?
Are there any what?
Are the operations matters that are coming up that you already know about, that you suspect?
any operational matters.
Right.
You know, right now, if there was there, it's not on the forefront of my mind. You know, this is going to slow down. This is going to slow down just other work that we were progressing on, as it is for everyone around us. So we're not losing any distance, so to speak. Everybody's slowing down. You know, at some point when things normalize, and we don't know when that is, we'll start to then regroup and we'll start to build back up again. But right now, I mean, it's changing every day, every hour. So we're going to just kind of get through this evolution, get through this incident, and then and unfortunately there are operational things that will come up, like the issue of construction. I mean, this is a prime construction period. I mean, if I were to look at the bright side of things of the higher ed letting out early, is, you know, the city's construction period is untainted, unbothered by graduation and all the traffic that goes on. Like, if it was a different situation, they could start earlier. So, you know, we have to figure out most of that work is bid. So milling and paving is bid out. Will those private contractors be doing that work or not? And if they are, you know, can we still award the bids and keep moving forward? And if so, great. Those are kind of discussions. That's like the next step now as to what are the next series of discussions we have. And then there's also, I should mention, obviously a budget impact that we have to now look through everything through a lens with. It's, one thing I haven't talked about, but I'll end my report and then I'll be done, is, you know, this week I'm going to spend some time with some folks looking at probably instituting some changes and temporary changes internally as we monitor finances and monitor expenditures.
Jason, can you turn to the mic a little bit?
I'm sorry. We'll be spending some time and probably putting in a few measures to internally to monitor expenses. Revenues are going to decrease in certain areas. Expenditures are going to be important to monitor. I'll communicate some of those initiatives by the end of the week to the legislature and to the staff. But some capital projects that we want to do may have to be looked at differently or postponed or reconsidered, as a variety of other things. So there is a budget impact. The revenues will be hit. Expenses will be challenged. I had a conference called NYSAC today, and the message from NYSAC is that the counties should expect to have significant cuts from the state in terms of our budget impact. So I have to take all that into consideration as we kind of weather this storm.
No questions around the room. I want to just make sure Amanda or Martha don't have a question there before Jason continues.
Just thanks, Mr. Sunshine.
Yep, that's what I'm here for.
that wasn't a question, Martha. Go ahead, Jason.
I'd like to just add, and I'll close on this because it's been a when you have great people working with you, it makes your job easier. And I can't imagine what it would be the other way around. You know, you have someone like Frank as the public health director, and Frank has been exceptional. And the amount of decisions that he has had to make as an individual and the role that he has as the public health director, I don't think people understand the public health law and the amount of responsibility that is put on his shoulders. And at a time like this, it is looked at with a magnifying glass. And he has performed exceptionally. He has made decisions under pressure that I don't think he could have comprehended. And the team that he has with him is a tribute to his leadership, and we are fortunate to have someone as strong of a leader as Frank in this role. And it's made, I think it positions this community very well to weather this storm. And that goes for the whole team at EOC. But, Frank, you have been an exceptional leader of what you're doing right now. It's incredibly stressful. And you look like hell, but you're doing a great job.
Not that bad.
Thank you.
You look good.
You look good.
You look good.
And we're getting very close and intimate on a lot of issues. But
for a guy who's not getting any sleep, you look terrific.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Frank, I think, Jason's sentiments definitely echoed by all of us around this room. This particular incident is really a true testament of the leadership we have in our organization. So we're incredibly thankful to you and your team at the health department and the rest of the staff. So thank you.
Thank you.
I gave him a beer from us. Yeah. Ginger beer.
Oh, I was like, are we feeding them beer now? We need them to stay alert.
Could have some of those.
That's a sugar rush right there.
So, Leslyn, if I could just end on an upside in all of this, our social media platforms have become extremely popular. So we're hopeful that when we navigate through all of this, all of our other public health messaging will be just as popular now that we have all these followers. And I am going to need Jason tomorrow, so as soon as you can get him to bed would be as helpful as possible. So thank you all.
All right. Thank you very much, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
That helped tremendously. I want to take this quick opportunity as we continue to talk about this just to make what I consider a public service announcement. I don't know if any one of you, but I know I have gotten text messages and emails and at least one phone call from folks who are concerned about people being harassed in our community, particularly those who are Asian American, students, folks who are following behind them. Today, one young lady being followed and being called by folks virus, and they're following her, which is scary. It's been happening too much. And I do want to encourage our community to please be sensitive. Please do not, let me just be plain, please do not do things like that. You know, this thing could have come from anywhere, any place. There's all over the world it's happening. And so to pin it on one group of people is not okay. To begin to make people feel threatened and uncomfortable walking the streets of their own community is not okay. And so I want to, again, encourage people to please stop that behavior. I also want to encourage others who see it to interrupt it. Please don't just be standing by. Please interrupt it and please lend support to the folks who are being harassed. We need to stop that. It's just too much going on in our community trying to fight this for us to have to deal with stupidity. I'm just going to name it that. So please stop. On that.
Leslyn, if I could add something.
Yes.
I just on to take the other side of that. I absolutely agree with what you said. I'm starting to think about all the people that we have to thank. You know, the healthcare workers everywhere, all of our employees, but even grocery store and pharmacy workers.
Yes.
The census workers, postal carriers, and the media. I think if we didn't have, you know, the media that we have, we would all be even more isolated and confused. So thank you all for doing this. If I were there, I would start a round of applause right now. So if somebody wants to do that, you know.
You can start it. You're on the phone. We can hear it.
Thank you.
It may seem strange to be applauding when we're in the middle of a crisis, but we are tackling this head on and doing well. I need to make part of my report. I need to also do some appointments. We go on to the other regular part of our agenda. Appointments to the advisory boards, which are not going to be meeting soon. Oh, never mind. Oh, here we go. To our negotiations teams. Continuing with the corrections unit, Rich John and Ann Corman. Road Patrol, Seville. Henry Granison and Mike Lane. CSEA Blue, Shauna Black and Glenn Morey. CSEA White Collar, Shauna Black. TC3, faculty, Mike Lane, will continue. PAA, Shauna Black, adjunct, Glenn Morey, and TC3 CSEA, Glenn Morey as well. So those appointments are in place. Thank you all very much for agreeing to serve in those capacities. Well, we've already got a long report from Jason. I wonder, do we have Rick and or Jonathan on the phone?
I am on the phone.
Hi, Jonathan.
I'm on the phone, too.
Welcome back. Any report from you, Jonathan?
Sure. As most of you probably know, I'm on quarantine. So if you really want to thank Frank for something, it's probably that, keeping me away. I do want to say that, you know, I knew that I was not going to be able to attend in person, and Greg and Lauren and IPS staff set up the Zoom. And it really is incredibly good, and I've got to compliment them on that. And, you know, everybody's been...
Jonathan, talk closer into your phone, please.
Sure. I was saying that, you know, Greg and Lauren and ITS set up this Zoom, which is really good. And, you know, I knew from the beginning that I wouldn't be able to participate in person. And it's, you know, I really got to compliment them on how well this is set up. I hear everything. And apparently you don't hear me as well, but I certainly hear you. And, you know, I mean, everybody said how great Frank and Jason and the whole team has done, and they really have. It's been amazing. But Leslin's leadership has been great, too. You know, it's really been a top-down thing. And so there's not much else I've been doing other than this stuff. But thanks, and that's my report.
Thanks, Jonathan. And when we're done with this, I'd like a restraining order against the county administrator. For phone calls, that is. No calling me. Thank you. Rick, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, but I have no report. I'm next door listening to you from here. It's crystal clear.
Thank you very, very much, Rick. Is it okay if I say that we just had a tobacco, what is it, security something annual meeting?
Yeah, we got through it, didn't we? That was a big one.
Can you just share with the legislature a little bit about what it was? I know it's...
Yes, we had our annual... We had our annual board meeting. That was the first one for Leslin, and we were able to accomplish all the year's activities, the budget, the financial statements per task, all in one meeting. So you might want to consider that there at the legislature.
Thank you very much, Rick.
You're welcome.
All right. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? Committee chairs, get off your cell phones and pay attention. Yes. Any resolutions to be added or withdrawn?
Anna does.
Mine went through committee.
Went through committee?
Correct.
It still needs to be added to the agenda.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yes, I do have one to add. It is a resolution calling for statewide issuance of temporary moratorium on evictions and foreclosures during state of emergency. I'm happy to talk to people about it.
All right, let's just, and so you're moving to add that to the agenda?
Committee, does it need 8 or 10?
It needs 10 to add it to the agenda.
Okay, I'm happy to explain it to people if that would help people understand what this is about before they vote.
Can we just get a second? Does anybody need an explanation of this before we add it to the agenda? We've had a long time already. Mm-hmm. I know one needs an explanation right now. Anybody on the phone?
No. No, I'm ready.
All right. So we're going to go to add it to the agenda. All in favor of adding... Oh, roll call vote. Sorry. Everything has to be roll call vote tonight.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
No.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
No.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes. Excuse me, yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes, to add it to the agenda.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 2 noes.
Okay, well, add it to the agenda. Thank you very much. I want to point out that many of you might have yellow resolutions in your folder. Yellow is usually reserved for the chair of the committee, but there was a mistake in printing, as in everything else that's going on. So we just want to point out, you know, we're doing different.
You're all yellow.
So you all have yellow.
We're all winners.
Be confused that we've now made you the chairs of every committee. That hasn't happened.
All right. Mm-hmm.
So we didn't want to waste paper and trees and so on. We were being good. All right. Consent agenda. These are resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of a standing or special committee. Let me go to the appointments. I have Margaret Kurz-Gessner, Town of Danby Representative to the Youth Services Board and to the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Larry Roberts, Community Member Representative, and Robert Brown, Community Member Representative. For the resolutions, Health and Human Services Committee, Resolution A, authorizing social services to accept NCCANFAR grant. That was pending committee action. Okay, no one wants that pulled. Housing and Economic Development Committee. Resolution B, authorizing Federal Transit Administration Section 5311 grant application for TCAT, Tompkins Consolidated Area Transit, and Tompkins County ID 9217. There is a revised version that was adopted by the committee. Government Operations, Resolution C. Approval of 2020 succession of members of the county legislature to serve in the absence of the chair and vice chair, ID 9224. Did somebody say pull or was that good dinner?
It's Jonathan's dog.
Oh, I thought it was, you know, good dinner burp or something. Resolution D, approval of appointment to the Tompkins County Council of Governments, ID 9219. Resolution E, resolution to update the Administrative Policy Manual, Policy 0149, public notification of construction activities, Policy 0209, separation and reinstatement of employees from county employment, and Policy 0412, reinstated employees, ID 9211. All right. Can I have someone move the appointments and consent agenda? Moved by Rich, seconded by Deborah. And
approved. And Jonathan's dog.
And Jonathan's dog. Voice vote again. Again, we have to do a roll call vote. Our voice vote.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much. That carries unanimously. Moving on to our standing committee reports and resolutions. I'm going to ask you to please make your reports as crisp as possible.
Can we take a break?
A break? Like, seriously, I'm trying to barrel through this. All right. There's a call for a five-minute break. It is 7:43. Okay. It's 7:44. Let's make sure we're back here at 7:50.
All right.
Take a break. Take a stretch.
I'm glad you're not my mother.
Let's reconvene. Oh, everybody is back. Hello, folks on the phone. Amanda, Martha, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I just heard one voice.
Amanda, my
name. This is Amanda.
Okay.
I don't hear Jen's dog.
All right.
Well, we're here.
Okay.
Thank you all so much for reminding me that you need a break. You have to keep me in line.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old military me. What can I say? So, yes, let's move on to our standing committee reports. Complete Census Count Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Yes, we haven't met since our last meeting here at the legislature, but sadly, because of all the events, we were not able to do one of our primary planning tools to try to get people to respond to the census, and that was the press conference we were planning to have this Friday. Library being closed, everything else that's been going on, the reduction in the number of people, we simply had to, in consultation with our public information advisory board, cancel that. We hope that perhaps in April we'll be able to do something else. It'll all depend on what all of this effort that we're going through turns out to be, whether it's going to be a two-week effort or five-week effort or whatever it's going to be. We just have to stay tuned. The questions we've been having for the most part is with the colleges sending students home, how are we going to get a proper census count for those students who are supposed to be counted here, but the census day is April 1st. And we have been following up with the folks of the census, and of course they're all going through a lot of consternation over all of their plans being upset by COVID-19. But I sent to you all a copy of what I got yesterday from Jennifer Carius, one of our partnership specialists from the census, in response to my question about what was new about counting our students. And I just want to read part of it. She wrote back with this information. The U.S. Census Bureau is adjusting some operations as outlined below with two key principles in mind: protecting the health and safety of our staff and the public, and fulfilling our statutory requirement to deliver the 2020 census counts to the president on schedule. Regarding on-campus group quarters counts, we are adjusting operations to make sure college students are counted. The U.S. Census Bureau recently concluded the 2020 Census Group Quarters Advanced Contact Operation, during which our field staff contacted college, university student housing administrators to ask them to select enumeration methods for their students. Our census teams will work with each college and university when they are available to do so. Regarding off-campus counts, in general, students in colleges and universities temporarily closed due to COVID-19 will still be counted as part of this process. Even if they are home on Census Day, April 1st, they should be counted according to the residence criteria that states they should be counted where they live and sleep most of the time, which is where they attend school. We are asking schools to contact their students and remind them to respond. Please emphasize that this is a directive from the census. We ask you to reinforce this in your public statements.
keep in mind that the highest response rate is within 2 days after receiving the census invitation by mail, and I know a lot of people here are already receiving it. And when this was written a day or so ago, they said 5 million people have already completed the survey online as of yesterday. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's nationwide. And that the Census Bureau was making changes to their media campaign. They wanted us to know that. Also, I inquired about whether they are still hiring people for the outreach for the census, and the reply I got is yes. So they're still looking for people to fill the slots, but I assume that it's going to be a while before everything is ironed out about when they will actually be going door to door as necessary.
Thank you. Mike, question. So, Mike, Deborah?
This isn't for Mike, but I got a text from Amanda that says she can't, the sound's not coming through on the.
Oh, no. I can hear you now.
Close it and refresh. Oh.
Okay.
No, I can hear you now.
Okay,
that
good.
Was before.
All right.
That's all I have.
Question? Anna?
Yeah, Mike. I've heard from a bunch of people who've tried to apply online and has found it almost impossible, if not impossible, to get through. It's a very lengthy process, not getting calls back, not knowing when the training is. I heard specifically from someone who works at TC3 who tried to encourage students to do that. They weren't able to get through. Is there any protocol? Has there been difficulty, but it's something they're clearing up in making sure they get back to people? Do you know anything about that? Is there any protocol we could publish to help people understand?
And I haven't heard any of that, but I'd be glad to contact Mike Kaplikalair about that. He's the specialist for one of the specialists for Tompkins County, the lead one.
Right, and I know there are other agencies as well who've reached out to me. That was just one example, but that would be great if you could.
I'll be glad to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Amanda or Martha, any questions from you?
No, thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Mike, again. Moving on. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Yeah, Downtown Facilities has not met since the last legislature meeting. Next potential meeting of that group will be April 9th.
Thank you, Dave. Any questions for Dave? April 9th. All right. Moving on. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslie. The Public Safety Committee is scheduled to meet this Thursday at 3 p.m. here in Chambers. However, I've reviewed the agenda, and it's a good example of the difference between important and urgent. I believe that there's several really important items. None of them are urgent. And from a public safety perspective, many of the people we'd be having attend our meeting are highly engaged elsewhere. Having talked to the committee members and Jason and our chair, I would recommend that we cancel the Public Safety Committee and pick up these important items in April.
Public safety canceling for this week, this month. Pick up the important items in April.
Yes.
Questions for Rich. Anybody has any concerns about that? Yes,
I would ask if there are reports, because HHS got reports from, or is getting reports from department heads in writing, if that's, maybe that's a measure we could ask for,
yeah.
Or, you know, just brief reports.
You can do that.
For example, the question I had earlier about anybody incarcerated awaiting
okay.
court trial.
We can do that.
Good point. Jason?
I just want to confirm
Thank
that
you.
Legislators received copies of the Lobella studies.
No.
You've not received them yet? You haven't gotten
them? No.
No. Okay. I'll find out what happens.
Thank you for that. So we'll have an extra month to look through it.
All right.
And that can go to all of us, not just committee members?
Yeah, we'll send it out to everyone.
It was going to all legislators.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Moving on, Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you. We met yesterday, and I would like to move Resolution F, Resolution of the Tompkins County Legislature, calling on members of the New York State Senate and Assembly to reject the Governor's through 21 executive budget proposal to shift 100% of the cost of 730.20 competency restoration services to the county mental health commissioners, ID 9242.
Moved by Shauna, seconded by Deborah.
And is that the...
There's a revised version, is there?
Yes.
As revised by committee?
Yes, there is a revised version.
That's what you're moving?
That's exactly right, yes.
Any questions?
I could explain a little bit. So this actually was brought forth by Jason. Thank you so much for writing this up. There were some edits by Martha. And this is something that we contribute 50% to currently. Whenever someone is struggling with mental health and needs to have services rendered, we pay for 50% of that. Last year it was around $700,000. We paid $350,000. The state pays $350,000. Now, under the governor's current proposal for the budget, he is telling counties that we should pay 100% of it. So that would be an extra $350,000 that our county would be picking up the tab for. So thank you for writing this resolution. I am definitely in support of this.
Thank you for bringing it to your attention. Well, the state is going to balance its budget on the backs of everybody. The poor, the sick, the in-between.
Everybody but Wall
any
Street.
Other,
yeah, right.
Everybody but the wealthy. Any other, any questions? All right, voice vote?
No.
Pardon?
Roll
call.
Glenmore?
Same difference. I want to hear your voices.
Glenmore?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries unanimously. Anything else, Shauna?
Great. As far as my report, we did have some liaison assignments. Community Mental Health Services Board will be myself. Dan Klein, alternate. Health Planning Council will be myself. Homeless and Housing Task Force, Deborah Dawson. Office for the Aging Advisory Committee, Dan Klein. Senior Citizens Council and Lifelong, Dan Klein. Tompkins County Youth Services Board, Glenn Morey. Human Rights Commission, myself. Human Services Coalition, Anna Kellis. And we also, I just want to announce that we do have an opening for the Alcohol and Drug Council. If any one of you would like to join that as a liaison, please let me know. It meets the third Wednesday of the month at 5 p.m. at the Mental Health Building. We also talked... Yes.
Go ahead, Martha.
I thought I was Human Services.
I have been, so...
Oh, I didn't have you down, Martha.
I've been doing it for the last couple of years, so I offered to continue.
I went to the last meeting. Whatever you need, I thought you needed somebody.
Okay, sorry, I did not have that.
We have the Alcohol and Drug Council.
Yeah, EDC meets at the actually place on Tripham Road, the new building.
Okay, I'll write that then. So, Martha, would you like to do that, or Anna?
Yeah, I was expecting to do a Human Services Coalition.
Okay, then we'll have you do it since Anna's done it for the past few years.
Fine.
We'll switch it over. And
okay,
then we still have Alcohol and Drug Council, so if anyone would like that, please let me know. I know that we're all busy, but this is going to be a very big year for them, and it would really be nice to have a liaison. We also talked about priorities just a little bit during our committee meeting. We really didn't want to do a deep dive because all of our department heads were not in attendance due to the fact that they are working hard right now. However, we did come up with just some basic goals for the upcoming year. This is definitely subject to change. Goal number one, work with administration and public health department to support efforts to combat COVID-19, keep legislature and public informed. Number two, track the financial impact for COVID-19 on the county social safety net agencies and non-for-profits that report to the committee. Number three, Medicaid costs and impacts on our county. And these, the additional topics are the Medicaid costs. Also, healthcare, home care costs, turnover of healthcare staff, and low pay and legalization of marijuana. And that's my report. Thank you.
Any questions for Shauna? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shauna, and thank you for everyone who liaison assignments. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
The next meeting of the committee will be this Thursday, the 19th, and we're starting a little bit earlier this time at 8:30 a.m. It'll be here in chambers, and we're doing that so that we can get through, hopefully, most of our agenda, and then we'll have a joint meeting at 9 o'clock with the Budget Committee. That's to do with the airport resolutions on the bonding.
Okay. Yes, Annie, questions?
I just wanted to mention that I had spoken previously for this meeting. I had to leave about 9:30 to get to Ulysses for a meeting. But that meeting has been changed till 10:30, and it's changed to a virtual meeting. So I'm more flexible with my time that morning for those two meetings.
Glad to hear it.
All right. Beautiful. Thank you very much. Anything else for Mike? Thank you,
yeah,
Mike.
Yeah, Mike, I would say if we had played with, we had decided facilities would start at 8:30 and then switch to the joint meeting at 9 because there was a prior meeting I was trying to work around. That prior meeting has been canceled. If it would work better for you that we start budget at 8:30, then do the joint, the joint meeting at 8:30, and then just move over to facilities. That sounds fine too. Either way you'd like.
I think we've advertised it. I think we should do it this way.
Yep. Yeah. But thank you for the suggestion.
Yep.
All right.
Okay, great.
Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for listening to my froggy voice. We met last, March 5th, which seems like an eternity ago now. We had a good meeting. We talked about some more policies. We did create a subcommittee of Rich, Dan, and myself, who are at some point going to sit down and look at the rules of the legislature and go through that document and see what possibly needs to change, what we want to revise, and kind of start to work through that. We also talked about GO priorities, which is to continue to work through county policies. I believe the number that Lisa gave us was last year we worked through 38 policies, which was pretty great. And hopefully this coming year we can do at least that many again, although I know things are changing now. We also had a really good discussion about the redistricting process, which is also on our list of priorities for the year. And I think we made some good progress. I'm not sure where that conversation is going to go now. We'll, I guess, kind of have to see how folks want to move forward with talking about that. Let's see. I think the other thing that is also going to kind of fall by the wayside now is to kind of finish up the website upgrade. And I had started to talk to Greg about that about 2 weeks ago, and so that's also going to kind of be put on hold. But there has been progress on the website, so hopefully at some point in the future when things calm down, that will come back around again. So I have one resolution that was one policy that did not end up on the consent agenda because we did not have a unanimous vote, and that is Resolution G. To update the administrative policy 2-41, prohibition of weapons, explosives, and firearms on county property. And I would move that.
Seconded by Henry. Questions?
And
guess I would just say if people have questions, maybe Henry could answer them, so it might be a little easier.
Questions, comments? Mike Sigler?
So I'm the reason this is not on the consent agenda. Not only will I not vote for this policy, I think we should rethink this entire policy. I don't understand why I would vote to strip myself of a right to self-defense. I frankly don't even know where that comes from. The state of New York, very regulated state when it comes to firearms. To get a pistol permit in this county right now, you actually can't get a pistol permit in this county because the sheriff's department isn't taking applications at this moment because of the coronavirus. But even if they were, it would be a long process to actually get a pistol permit and to be able to conceal that. Included in this policy is mace and pepper spray. I don't think it's wise to require our people, our employees, to basically be completely defenseless if somebody were to attack them. I don't really understand that policy. You know, I know there's a lot of people against guns. I get that. To own a gun in New York State is still legal. There are things you have to do to actually go get one. Some people believe this week, in fact, that you could just walk in and get a long gun, which they found out isn't true either. So I frankly don't understand this policy. In it, we say that, you know, certain people are exempt. I understand that part, the deputies, other departments, other federal police officers, for example, you know, FBI, obviously state police officers. Not included in the list is judges. Judges are exempt, should also be exempt from this. I think lawyers should probably be exempt from this, but under state law they're not, but judges are. I don't understand why we would give a certain level of rights to a certain group of people when I should and deserve that same right. We had a legislator who I'm pretty sure was armed a lot of the time while he sat at this table. Don't know if he was or not, because I mean that's kind of the purpose of concealed carry, is to not actually know if the person is armed. I always felt a great deal of solace behind that. The things I don't particularly want to see happen, and I voted against before here, are things like metal detectors for people coming in. I think that creates a barrier with the public, and I think when you do things like this, the chances of those kind of things being needed increase. I don't like the idea of our people who, you know, sometimes might leave here at night, sometimes are just leaving under, I don't know, their personal situations. And we are saying to them, yes, we're not going to let you have anything on county property whatsoever to defend yourself if you are put into an awkward situation or a dangerous situation. So I would rethink this entire policy. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Your very cogent thoughts. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. We'll take it to a vote. Roll call.
Glenn Morey?
No.
Martha Robertson?
I can just make a quick comment. I understand what you're saying, Mike, and I have mixed feelings, but I'll vote yes.
Mike Sigler?
No.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
No.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
11 ayes, 3 noes.
That carries. Thank you very much. Anything else from GO? No.
Yeah, just to say that our next meeting is April 2nd at 1:45, and I guess we'll just kind of see how things evolve, and, I'm looking at the agenda, and we'll kind of keep it as bare as possible in terms of things that have to be taken care of at that point. So, thank you.
Thanks, Amanda. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deb Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have not met since the last legislative meeting. We have a very stripped-down agenda for next Monday's meeting. We just have resolutions that need to be passed. And we'll also be rescheduling the public hearing for the Ag District update that we voted on at our last legislative meeting. We will be talking briefly about our goals for the coming year. We started that conversation at our last meeting. I plan to update the committee on how those jive with DPS's work plan for the year. Anna and I met with Katie last week to make sure that we were all pretty much singing off the same page. And we think that was helpful. So thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Deb. Any questions for Deb? No? All right, moving on. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. We, as Mike has already said, we will meet as a joint committee with Facilities and Infrastructure at 9 o'clock on Thursday morning. I'll be calling in again to deal with airport issues. And Jason had asked us to do this in a joint meeting so that we could pass them at the following legislature meeting without having to wait another cycle. So. After that, the next budget meeting is scheduled for April 13th at 3 o'clock. And at the meeting that we did have, as Amanda said, seemed like a long time ago, March 9th, we talked mostly about a number of things, but mostly about goals, you know, looking at last year's goals and then looking at goals for 2020. Mostly I'm thinking we can probably dump the goals we talked about, except track broad economic conditions, look for opportunities and red flags. I'm pretty sure we're going to be doing that. In particular, I'll probably when Jason gets a chance to take a breath, I will bring up the question of, do we need any mid-year budget adjustments? We did that in, I think, 2009. In the recession. So we may need to take a look at our 2020 budget and see if we actually need to make any changes. I would remind folks that we have the April 28th budget retreat scheduled, and somehow we're going to have to, I assume, we have to move these things along. The budget is, the calendar is what the calendar is. And so let's plan that will happen again on April 28th, Tuesday night at 5:30. Jason, I want to ask you a couple of things. You said you were on the phone to NYSAC. Do you have any update? Do you have any sense of whether our home rule bills, the 3% sales tax and the airport bonding bills, yes, what are they doing with those kinds of things?
I do have a little bit. It looks like tomorrow there will be an ominous bill to extend all home rule bills that exist, including sales tax. They didn't have much more, but it looks like it's been being worked on. There'll be an ominous bill to have all home rule bills continue to be extended in one swipe. I did not ask about the airport bonding because it was a conference call with all other counties. I can go through real quick. They are rejected, or everyone is hoping to reject the Medicaid changes. And from what I understand, according to them, Thursday or Friday, they're looking to have a finalized budget to be talked about.
When did the White House bills come in?
I don't know. I think that's what they referred to as finalizing that by Thursday and Friday so they can start to debate the budget. The movement seems to be quick because of COVID-19. So there's reason to believe that they were going to move on this very quickly. On the federal side, the EFMAP discussion, the House bill passed, I think it's 6201, with a $5 to $6 billion $5 to $6 billion going to New York State counties, I believe, with respect to Medicaid relief. But there is still a lot of question and challenge, although I think Senator Schumer did, from what they're saying, exceptional job ensuring that this goes to the counties. There's still a lot of question as to what's going to happen to the prior EF map that exists that hasn't been paid out yet. Also mentioned two economic stimulus packages, the President's and the House of Representatives, which are different ends of the spectrum, but it was to the tune of $750 billion were talked about. They did stress severe cuts or should be expected with counties with the state budget. They talked about the revenue numbers, and there's a letter out, I think, to the comptroller, where the revenue projections were estimated, and that the original revenue projections were incorrect from the governor's budget. They were should be lower, and that with the compounded with the potential negative impacts from the economy from this COVID-19, you're talking about anywhere between $4 to $7 billion lower than what they were projected so far. That's what potential receipts could be. So, on the bright side of things,
there's a bright side.
The bright side is that there seems to be bipartisan support against the Medicaid changes, and they want to reject part R of the proposed budgets.
Good.
That's what I have from the NYSAC discussion.
All right.
So, again, Mr. Sunshine, thank you for that information.
Very welcome. Very welcome.
So we're sliding into the Intergovernmental Relations Committee, but that makes sense, too. And Jason, I'm seeing on the news that the Senate is going to pass 6201 as it is. They don't like it. They're trying to come up with another bill that's even bigger. So, but 6201 is the one that had the Medicaid, Medicaid share, additional $6.7 billion estimated to New York State.
Mm-hmm.
We did get an urgent message from NYSAC over the weekend that the governor was attacking that bill because it was going to require the federal share. It was going to require that counties get the federal share as established in 2009, and he didn't like that at all. So, it sounds like it is going through anyway. The folks should know that every one of our New York congressional members did vote for that bill. So Jason, I've been aware that they're trying to do this all really fast. There are two members of the legislature that actually are positive for COVID-19, and they want to get the business done. They've of course closed the Capitol building to external visitors. So do you have any sense that there's any way we can weigh in, or is this train just moving too fast?
I think you can still weigh in. I think it's just going to require you to call and email your our representatives and other elected officials. You're just not going to be able to lobby. I mean, it's a very difficult time. You've got the federal government that's in response to this issue, nationwide. You've got the state that's in response to this issue statewide. You've got a already challenging budget outlook even before this, got heavy. When the governor's executive budget was proposed, it already was assuming some financial challenges and strains, and now you throw this on top of it, which is unprecedented. It's just a perfect storm. The point is that that the reality, and I think I've said this before, the state and federal governments have to finance the recovery and outcomes from this. We cannot do it locally. While we are in a good position financially for ourselves, most counties in New York State cannot and will not, and neither can we, pay for the recovery of this. So there has to be changes in their approaches. From what I understand, the federal stimulus packages, while are both trying to achieve the same thing, they're from coming at opposite ends of the spectrum with respect to the different parties at the federal level. So it seems like this is moving very fast at the state level. They want to get this done, which is good, and it is bad because you don't want decisions to be made that are going to negatively impact us in haste because they have to move on to another issue. We are going to be faced with the same similar type discussions about upcoming capital projects and budget decisions that are being pinched because of this current response. So I think you can still contact our Assemblywoman Lifton, our three senators, and the folks that we have been lobbying. You're going to have to do it remotely. You're not going to be able to do it in person. And you have to try to get a phone call with them if you can, if they're willing to take it, and you just have to keep pushing that way because obviously we can't go to the Capitol, and they're, that's the only way you're going to get a hold of them.
Right. Can I just finish up on this, and this will be my second committee report?
Sure.
Okay, just briefly, that we did meet with Barbara Lifton. She came over to the chambers, and I think 10 of us met with her. We had a good meeting with Senator Tom O'Mara in person as well. We had a great phone call with Senator Pam Helming. So we have real, I think, positive, very, very strong support among our delegation. I did reach out to Senator Seward's office. They had problems for several days with their phone lines, and so I never connected. And then all of this hit the fan. So I haven't followed up with Seward. But I think we can be confident that they really feel strongly about supporting the counties in this Medicaid issue. Jason, would you like me to follow up, I guess, with Lifton's office on the airport bonding bill to make sure that's in the omnibus?
Yeah, I think that that's important. I would suggest yes, if you can follow up with that, for sure. I don't know if it'll be in that bill, but at least it's moving forward. Yes.
Right. If it's in that, let's hope it's in the omnibus bill. And I'm really glad we got our 3% sales tax measure pushed forward already too.
Okay.
All right. Unless there are any questions about budget, capital, and personnel, or Tompkins intergovernmental relations, then those are my two reports.
Thank you very much, Martha. It also raised something that Jason said, just talking about recovery and stimulus packages. It also raises an important question that we would have to grapple with here as well, because we know that the agencies and out in the community that will be looking to us in the light of this COVID-19 for support. It's for us, it's a little too early in the process right now. As we said, we're in just the infancy stages of response, and we don't even know what the impact will be on us as county government, let alone in the entire community. So we ask everybody for their patience as we try to navigate these new waters here. Eventually we'll get to, and hopefully it will be recovery that will be coming from state and federal government and not necessarily local government, because we are not sure that we could do that, even for our own selves. Thanks, Martha. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Ann Corman, Chair.
Thank you. We haven't met since our last meeting. I had a telemeeting with the Vice Chair, Henry Granison, earlier today, and we talked about if there were any priorities or urgent business, and we decided to cancel the next meeting, which is next week, so that would be Wednesday the 25th. So and so let me know if I need to do anything else to cancel that, Kathy.
Nope.
Okay, and then a little bit concerning this, I had a question just now from a constituent who saw our notice about daycares, centers being closed, and they said if we had any advice on how to find child care quickly. And another concern they had was that their workplace is not adhering to keeping people 6 feet away. And did we have any, what is she supposed to do? Just the messenger.
Thank you for the message. We'll make sure that our health department continues to put out to people those precautions of social distancing and all the things that they've been asking about. And I would encourage calling the Child Development Council, who is our go-to place for questions and information about child care.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Kellis, Chair.
You know, we figured we'd save the hardest for last.
We saved the best for last. Right, the best for last. Not hardest.
I'll get the easy bit of information out that our next HED meeting is next Thursday, the 26th at 9:30. Okay, that's the end of my report.
Awesome.
Yeah, and we can all get home. Okay, no, seriously. So our first bit of work is Resolution H, authorization to amend 2015 Memorandum of Understanding with the City of Ithaca and Cornell University to administer the Community Housing Development Fund. That is ID 9206. I so
move. Anna, I have a second. Second by Annie.
So I'm hoping we won't need much discussion on this. Everybody knows the Community Housing
any
Development Fund.
Any discussion? Any questions? Roll call vote.
Yes.
No, yeah.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously. Continue, Anna.
The next one that we've all been waiting for, that is number I, commitment to terms between the City of Ithaca and Tompkins County to support the Community Conference Center. That is ID 9245, and I so move. And then I will talk about it briefly.
Moved by Anna, and that's what's in your folders. That was committee took action this afternoon. Moved by Anna, seconded by Mike. Is that what you're doing?
I just want to get
you. Oh, seconded by Annie.
That was revised as adopted.
So revised as adopted by committee, so you have that in your folders.
It's the revised version, yes, that I'm moving.
Thank you. Questions, comments?
I'm going to lead off.
Lead off, Anna. Go ahead.
Okay. So I just first want to acknowledge the fact that we are talking about an economic development issue in the face of, a crisis that we're in right now. We are being asked to hold space for that situation that we're in and simultaneously look into the future about how to stabilize our economy. And I just want to honor and acknowledge that all of us are holding space for that, and that is not, it doesn't make this any easier. We have been working on this for, 2 years now? It's a long time coming, or it has been worked on. We have had this in HED for the last 2.5 months. So I appreciate everybody's patience. We've had a big change in the resolution as of late. The current resolution, for the public who's watching, this resolution in summary would have the county putting 4% of the room tax into the conference center, and that money would go to the city to go into the conference center every year until and unless it is no longer a conference center, or the 30-year lease, whichever is sooner. So if it continues to be a conference center for the 30 years, then we would continue to put 4% of the room tax into the conference center. If it stopped being a conference center, then this fund would, transfer would not happen anymore. I think that's one thing that's really important. We would not be taking on the risk associated with this, so it's much more simple. There wouldn't be any significant administration from our planning department. They thanked us for that in our most recent meeting. So I did want to just start with that and acknowledge the situation and everybody's patience. And I'm just going to say a few things, that this is coming out of room tax. Room tax can be used for conference center. That is stated in state law. It is not coming out of anything but room tax. So if room tax goes down or up, it will always be a percentage, 4%. One of the things that impacted my decision, and I'll just share my little piece of this first and then open it up to the floor, I am in support of this. It has been a difficult process back and forth, but I'll just share my pieces and then you all can share. The impact to tourism, particularly given what we're going through now, but continuously, is severe, and I think that recognizing that this would mitigate that, ameliorate that to some extent, is important as a consideration. But at the same time, this project would not start for another 3 years. So we are really being asked to think long-term and not solely on the experience that we're having now. We have an economy right now that depends very heavily on higher education. Our tourism is constantly, or has been up to now, and will be in the future, growing and robust. And this is a way to support that. Our room tax has been flattening, and this is an opportunity to increase that. And I wanted to, given that a lot of people are going to speak tonight, I did want to share something that I got an email, and it was asked of me to share this with you because it did come in last week, and we didn't note it earlier. But these are the types of emails that have really influenced me. So this is from Tracy Fuller in the town of Ithaca, and I was asked to read this. This is the last thing that I will share. I encourage you to represent my interests and vote in support of this project. I work in sales and catering for the Hilton Garden Inn of Ithaca. This project is important to me for many reasons, but nothing more important than being able to support myself and my family while sustaining a fair quality of life. As a person who falls into the exact demographic of who should be able to afford living in downtown Ithaca and the Affordable Housing Project, I can honestly state that I would never be able to do so on my current income. Opportunities are limited for advancement with the current climate within the tourism industry today in Tompkins County. With little to no growth happening in rates and occupancy, hotels have to operate with less staffing and other overhead expenses, and yet continue to provide the same or better level of customer service our travelers expect to remain competitive. Year over year, wage increases are not always possible when profits are reduced. I worry without adding some kind of demand generator, other than being attached to the universities, this industry may have difficulty sustaining itself. I strongly believe that the addition of the Community Conference Center in downtown Ithaca would not only benefit my industry, but also our restaurants, shops, theaters, and outdoor activities. I hope you will consider my request, as this is very important to my future and many other individuals who fall into the same demographic as myself and our ability to work and live in Tompkins County. So, anyway.
Thank you, Anna. And I have a number of people in the queue for speaking. Thanks for the introduction of it. Mike Lane, Dan Klein, Deborah Dawson.
And Martha.
And Martha.
Thank
you.
Madam Chair, I will try to be crisp because at your request, remember that crisp was my word. And often,
I've borrowed it from you.
Often we had reports from WDIC that were not. Speaking before on this topic, I was not terribly proud of myself because I was sort of ambivalent, or quite ambivalent. I was right in the cusp of two kinds of thinking on it. I really want to thank the committees and people who worked on this to come back with a new proposal. It's made the difference as far as I'm concerned with this. I like the fact that we are contributing money for economic development. It is something that has a precedent that we did with our Tompkins County Area Development when we took some room tax to help them out during financial times. Excuse me. And so it's not being made something that we've never thought about using the room tax for before. State legislation doesn't say that we can use it to build conference centers. It says we could use it for conferences. So that is a little bit of a stretch. But I think the fact that we're going to put some money in here, we know how much money it's going to be or what percentage it's going to be. It'll go up and down with whatever the receipts are. This becomes a city project, and the city is going to operate it through the whatever processes they use, and not the county, and we don't have to oversee it. I think all of these things make a lot of sense for us, so I'm going to be supporting this.
Thank you, Mike. Dan Klein, Deborah Dawson.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
In the past, I have spoken forcefully against this. I raised a lot of concerns, and I applaud the effort that was made to address those concerns, and so I'm going to vote yes for this proposal because it does address almost all of my concerns. We are no longer acting as the loan guarantor. If the center goes out of business, we owe $0, and you can't touch the property tax based on this proposal. So that hits, you know, the really biggies in my mind. The one remaining concern I had had to do with the possibility that guaranteeing that a certain percentage of the hotel tax goes to the conference center under certain circumstances could take money away from the other recipients of the hotel tax. And under normal circumstances, that probably won't happen, or it's not going to be significant. We all know we're not under normal circumstances right now. So I am still voting for this, but I am asking HED committee to immediately look at how the hotel tax revenues can be reallocated this year, starting right away, to support the organizations that we do currently support and that we're eligible to support with tourism money, who are going to have a very difficult time weathering this storm. You know that we're not allowed to just give tax money away to all the worthy organizations in this county that we might like to. However, we are allowed to give hotel tax money to specific organizations that are tourism related. So the obvious ones, the easy one to identify, are the ACOT organizations that we've already screened as having a positive influence on tourism. And so I really hope that we will right away think about stopping some of the projects that were kind of longer term planning, signage, blue way trails, whatever, those kinds of things, and reallocate that money right away to organizations that are going to have a very difficult time surviving over the next few months. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Deborah, Martha.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
See you.
I've not been a big fan of the whole conference center thing. I'm still not a big fan of the conference center. I don't think it's going to be the magic bullet that everyone hopes that it will be. However, my major concern has been putting the county at risk with respect to the lease guarantee. And I commend Jason and his committee for finding a workaround that leaves us without that unpredictable risk. For that reason, I will probably support, I will be supporting this resolution with a couple of reservations. I'm doing this primarily because we've heard so much from the DIA organizations and businesses downtown about how badly they want this. And I want them to remember that if and when our room tax goes down because of an event like what we're experiencing now, and when there isn't as much money as they're asking for, this is going to take 4% out of the pot, and I don't want to hear any whining about that. The other piece of this that I continue to not be happy about is, despite the fact that this conference center thing has been in the works for a couple of years, the ask to the county has been pushed through in a relatively short time, and just today we heard from Vecino via IURA and through Jason that, you know, if Vecino didn't get this thing passed tonight here at the county, the conference center was probably a no-go. I don't want to be the Grinch that killed the conference center, even though I don't think it would be nearly as sorely missed as Christmas would be. So I will vote for it, but I ask that, you know, economic development projects like this not be pushed on us for support at the last minute again. Thank you.
So let the record reflect that Deborah wants no whining, and she's not a Grinch. Got it.
Well, that,
thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
I am going to encourage people. I think most people know where they're going to vote. I'm going to encourage people to, again, be crisp. You don't have to make these big, long speeches. If there's something specific you're trying to get, like Dan, you know, was sharing, you know, go there, and we don't have to respond to everybody's comments. So please, everybody is tired, and Jason is fading fast.
And Frank needs him in the morning.
Okay, Martha.
Thank you very much, and I'm smiling over here. Dan, I would hug you, except, you know, we can't. So I, in the vein of another mind being changed, the Stephen Engelman that we got an email from this morning, and I wrote back to him. He writes back to me, thank you for your perspective. You've made several very valid points that did need clarification for me. And he goes on to say, so even if it's mostly the city benefiting, since that is the county seat, I do believe this is worthwhile. I really feel like this is a good way to handle this, this 4% growth off the room tax. And I really appreciate all the incredible hard work that's gone in to make this happen. I do think it might be worth us, in the same way that we probably have to, you know, we should look at our 2020 budget and see if we have to make mid-year adjustments. The directive might be to STPB to go back and, you know, really take a hard look at everything that they've funded. For example, if there are festivals that aren't going to happen, they won't have incurred costs, which is different from an organization that has ongoing operating costs. So I think I know our advisory boards are basically asked not to meet for the time being, but that might be one that should keep working. So appreciate the thoughts, Dan, and everybody's and Mike Lane. Everybody's really careful evaluation of this, and I think it's a great project.
Thank you, Martha. Rich, then Mike Sigler.
I will be voting in support. Deborah, I think your criticism is valid. This process could have been better, and it certainly would have been probably less dramatic as a result. But overall, this does seem to be a very different risk profile for the county. The project certainly has risk associated with it, but the upside benefits bear the, I think, going forward. I did want to comment that we did receive a letter from a constituent indicating that we should be taking COVID-19 into account and vote against the conference center. And while certainly you can wonder about what's going to happen over the course of years, I think we have to look past COVID-19. If you look at any other pandemic situation, the Spanish flu, which, you know, was just a terrible event in our history, we carried on, and we will carry on from this as well. We need to look at the long-term economic health of the county, and this is a way to do it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rich. Mike Sigler, then Annie.
Don't worry, I don't want to talk too long because I can count heads. I see where this is going. So I'm glad for that. I plan to vote for this, but I want to explain myself too. As for Vincino coming in today, I actually had asked Jason a question earlier today because I had said, you know, if there was anything I could table, this would probably be something I would table. Not because it was written badly or because I wouldn't vote for it. It was just I didn't want the public to think that this is kind of superfluous. I know Martha, she sent out an email, but this actually convinced her more to vote for this. For me, that was not the case. For me, COVID-19, obviously something that's a concern. But again, this isn't going to be built for quite some time. And I don't want people to, like, particularly my constituents, to think a couple of things. That this wasn't considered. I mean, we've been talking about this. This is not something that's just popped up overnight. We've been trying to make the resolution better, and I think we've arrived at a point where some people who aren't going to vote for it are, because they're comfortable with it, and their concerns were valid, and we got a better resolution because of it. So I think that's a good positive democracy at action kind of step. I also wanted to tell my constituents, listen, I understand, Lansing, is this going to help us? Is this going to help the town? Maybe not, maybe on the periphery. But sometimes you vote for things because it's good for the county, and I think that this is. A strong county core is important. And this isn't coming out of your property taxes. This isn't getting sucked out from there. This is coming so that we can drive more tourism, and hopefully tourism for the whole county, which benefits the entire county. So I wanted to assure them that it wasn't like their property taxes were going to be going into something that we're not sure if it's going to work, because let's face it, we're not. But the administration has written this in a way that we have a good stopgap and we have a release valve, which is something that I think a lot of people were talking about. So my other big concern about voting for this tonight was that the public doesn't get to come and talk. It's been my experience that doesn't generally happen. And it does seem like we did get input from the outside, if not today, over the last month and a half. I think a lot of people have come in and voiced their concerns and also voiced their approval if it was there. So that's really what's won me over. I had planned to vote for some fashion of this before COVID-19 really kind of took over the world. And now I'm just happier that some of these concerns by, like, Deborah and Shauna and other people were brought up because, yes, we got a better bill because of it. So thanks.
Thank you, Mike Sigler, Annie, Anna, Shauna, Henry.
Thank you. I'm going to paraphrase something that was from Brittany Gripe from Sunny Days about giving people a little bit of hope to hold on to after the as we're going through and after the coronavirus subsides. And so once we get through this pandemic, we would like to look forward to a time when the flow of tourism through our amazing county will be steady enough to support our amazing businesses year-round. I've talked a lot to folks in my community, and they're mostly supportive of this because the people that work at the restaurants and the hotels that this is mostly going to affect, they work throughout our county. Those are our constituents. So I think it does directly affect my folks. I have one question, which on, let's see, the second to last whereas. On the third line where it says commit to paying prevailing wages during construction, okay, past that, I guess, then as it keeps going, and reporting on such wages, then the next line, commit to paying its employees living wages. I was hoping that would be more referenced to the conference center employees.
We can't dictate that anymore. We lost our seat at that table.
Oh, that's right, because we, right. The money is a different way.
Yep. Certainly can encourage
right.
it.
All right. A little tired.
Question,
thank you.
Ask and answer. Thank you very much. Anna, Shauna, Henry.
Shauna and Henry can go first.
Thank you very much.
So in the almost two and a half years that I've been on this legislature, this is the hardest vote that I've had. And I am stuck with the fact that we are just in such an uncertain time and our economy is really not in a good place. We don't have projections of it looking positive in the near future. I understand that people are saying that this is a way that will help us in 3 years, but the timing of this is really off for me. Had we voted on this 2 weeks ago, I would have voted for it. Jason and Katie and many, many people have spent so much time on this, and so I actually feel somewhat bad for thinking about voting against it. But in my heart, that's what I feel, and I have to vote that way. With that said, I think there are definitely concerns from nonprofits right now, from arts and culture people that are concerned about even being able to make payroll in the next upcoming weeks. So I do hope that we are able to figure something out. I mean, that's where I'm at.
Thank you, Shauna.
Thank you.
Henry?
Yes. I basically think that this is all about risk. And I was, in fact, generally for the conference center. But then I started looking at the risk and really deciding, okay, if we don't do this project, what happens? The city probably assumes the risk that we would, the $4.9 million that we would give over 30 years. But also, what's going to happen to the site? Going to be more affordable housing. I don't see that as a downside. I see that as a positive side. Now, there's no grocery store within walking distance of the site, which is another issue, but, you know. But, yeah, I also want to look at the studies. The only thing I found that was really comparable was the Saratoga Springs site, which I looked in and saw that it was built in 1984, hosted 175 events in 2017, and it brought in $985,000 in total operating revenue in that year. It incurred $1.7 million in operating expenses. That's close to double the amount of revenue. Saratoga Springs, they had between 12,000 and 18,000 room nights. We told our number is going to be 22,000 room nights once it's stabilized. And the Weedos are 203 events, 28 more than Saratoga Springs. The predictions in the study also talked about how that the closest that we would get our operating expenses would come to our revenue would be 50% during the first year. I just can't buy that. Now, I know that many of us have talked to a person who was on the IDA and talked about Professor Haywood Sanders. And I talked to Professor Sanders, and he said, yeah, their reports are off about 50% usually. And that Hunden never goes back to figure out how their forecast worked. Like, you know, basically do an analysis of, okay, I did a study 5 years ago, how do the numbers actually come out five years later? They never do that. They don't care. So I fear that this is just going to become, you know, a hole you throw money down. Now, I know that we've fixed it, and so we only have it coming out of hotel tax revenue. But, you know, we also know that the tourism industry is being ravaged at the moment. IC has moved their commencement to August 1st, and Cornell is still debating about whether they're going to hold commencement. Well, the UPenn and Michigan have canceled their commencements already. I'm also on the outdoor rec committee of the STPB, and we, in fact, were going to make a presentation on Wednesday to ask for more money out of the STPB. And so there's actually going to be more demand. And remember, outdoor rec was focused on as one of the biggest reasons why people come for tourism in this area. And so we would expect to receive some amount of money from the board. That would be in addition to the 4% that is going to go to this conference center. So I cannot vote for this. I could have easily supported it just hit out and just not said anything. But I thought it was important to say. And so that's, and also the return on investment. I know that we're estimated to receive $5.5 million over a 20-year period. We're going to pay out $4.9 million over 30 years. I don't really consider that a great investment. But we can differ. Thank you.
Thank you for your thoughts, Henry. Anna, do you want to wrap this up, and then we're going to take it to a vote?
Yeah, I did want to just thank everybody for the work, and honestly, every single one of you for doing your own analyses. I have been very impressed by every single one of you digging in the time period that we've been given, which wasn't ideal, I understand, particularly given everything that we have. So I really did want to thank all of you guys for putting that time in. I also wanted to thank the organizing committee that has worked on this. In my own research into conference centers, I have not seen any conference center business model that had five contingencies and, you know, two different agencies that were investing money and taking on risk, a room tax invested or a TID invested. I have just been so impressed by the ingenuity of this group to mitigate this risk. And I personally am very glad that it won't start for another 3 years. So we'll have that time to really bounce back, and let's focus our efforts over the next couple of years in stabilizing, supporting everybody in the economy. I will say the entire STPB is doing a full evaluation of all the different components, you know, not just ACOD, but all of them, and where the money is coming from, where it's going. And, you know, I know in outdoor recreation we had a conversation recently about how do we do short-term mitigation. I know the other groups are having that conversation as well. One of the things that was brought up is the fact that right now, given that people can't really convene closely together, one of the things that we do have to offer in nature is our outdoors. That is one place where I would actually say that we can carry a bit of our tourism by telling people to go to our waterfalls and tell people to go to our trails, because we might, well, not everybody, because then we'll all see each other outdoors. So that will defeat the purpose. But to some extent, that, you know, will really carry us. And some things that we should look forward to. So thank you all for your diligence, and hopefully this will move forward tonight.
Thank you, Anna. I forgot I intended to check in with Amanda to see if she wanted to say anything. Amanda?
No, I'm tired.
Okay, I imagine, and I can hear your voice going downhill as well. All right, let's just take this to a vote. Thank you all for your comments. Roll call.
Glenn Morey?
No.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
No.
Amanda Champion?
No.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
No.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
10 ayes, 4 noes.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. That carries. All right. We are done. We will.
We have one more resolution.
We have one more resolution, Anna.
Sorry, everyone. I will try to be quick on this, give you the summary of why I'm doing this. This is the resolution calling for statewide issuance of temporary moratorium on evictions and foreclosures during state of emergency, ID 9272. I so move. Thank you, Annie.
Second by Annie.
So just to give everybody a quick summary, right now there is a judicial order that is out to put a moratorium on evictions. It can be lifted at any time for any reason. The reason that I think something like 190 assembly members and a significant number of senators have brought this forward is because it creates a legislative action. And the resolution that I've outlined, I'm going to note a couple amendments to make clarifications. But the summary of this is that it does three things. One is through legislative action at the state that it would create a moratorium through legislative action on all evictions through the state of emergency and 30 days beyond that. So the second one is that it would create a protocol for amortization of arrears. And what that means, and that would be a 180-day period, what that means is as long as anyone has rent, for example, that they weren't able to pay during the period of the state of emergency, as long as after that state of emergency ends, 30 days past that, they continue to pay their current rent, then they will have a relationship or an agreement for an amortization of the back rent that they owe from the period of being in a state of an emergency. If at any point their current rent they don't keep up with, or mortgage if it is a landlord, then that agreement, they lose that agreement. So that is the amortization of the arrears that I'm talking about, and that is separate from the moratorium on evictions. The third is a moratorium on foreclosures, and that is specifically to protect landlords, small landlords, of which we have many in the area. So this is a bill that is already in the state, and I wanted to make some corrections to make this clear in the third whereas statement. It should say March and not May. There is an eighth whereas that has been added so that this is clear for everyone. That eighth whereas says, whereas on March 15th, 2020, the Office of Court Administration issued an order to suspend all current and pending eviction proceedings until further notice. In reaction to this judicial order, this resolution is a legislative action which seeks to quantify the moratorium, including foreclosure protections, and define amortization.
Not quite clear, but okay.
So I can change that. There's only thing in this when it says, in reaction, this resolution, I would say this state bill. So it is not our resolution, it's the state bill. In the first resolved, it should say the state bill. That upon passage of this, the state bill, not this resolution. And those are the amendments. And I apologize, this was written clearly, but it is those three things that this would do. The amortization, the moratorium on foreclosures, and the moratorium on evictions. And the last thing that I will say about this, I understand there's clarification needed. The whole entire purpose of this is because we are in a state of emergency that requires that people who have any symptoms stay isolated in their homes. If people do not have homes to be isolated in, then they cannot be isolated. So the whole purpose of this was to simply keep people in their homes so that we could address the COVID crisis.
And I I think that's actually a misstatement, that if people don't have homes, they can't be isolated.
That is true. It's to help the process of isolation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jason, did you have something you wanted to say?
No.
Okay. So I have Rich, Martha, Deborah. Mike Sigler. Rich?
Yeah, I understand the intent here. I don't see a resolve saying we support the state legislation, but as it reads, it looks like we're taking action, and I think it's beyond the powers of the county that we aren't.
I think I have a change that would address that.
Okay, hold on.
I worry that as written, it looks like we're questioning or intruding on the power of the courts. And we also might be subject to a taking action if we were infringing on the contractual arrangements between private parties. I'm wondering if this could be tabled and worked on a bit more, because as written, I don't think I can support it. I would suggest bringing it back at our next meeting after we have some time to work on it. So I would move to table.
Look at it.
Move by to table this and bring it back at our next meeting after it's been massaged some more, seconded by Dan. Moved by Rich, seconded by Dan.
I'd like to hear what Martha was offering.
Can you hold on? No, we've got a motion on the floor. Okay? Thank you. Comments on the motion that's on the floor? Deborah.
I would like to...
Got you, Martha.
Yeah, I agree with Rich's points. The way this is written, it makes me very uncomfortable. I can't discern which of these results are taken directly from the state bill and which are things that we might be adding on ourselves. I would like the county attorney to look at this. I'm in support of tabling it.
Okay, let me just clarify, actually. It's a motion to postpone, not table. Martha.
Thank you. You addressed what I realized was my problem with it. What if the first resolve said, on recommendation of the Housing and Economic Development Committee, Tompkins County supports that state bill, which would enact a temporary moratorium, et cetera, and then maybe I would just delete the rest of the resolves and say that we send this on to the state and federal representatives. It just one of the many things that we do where we support a bill, and the idea is here we want to encourage them to go ahead and put this in law. That's what we support. I would say if we table it, sounds like they're going to be out of Albany. The legislature will have adjourned before this comes back.
Point of order.
Thank you.
So I would support it if we modify it.
Point of order. Go ahead, Mike.
It was moved to table and was seconded. And then you said it was a motion to postpone. I guess we got to figure out which it is. Which did Rich intend?
I had intended to have it go back to committee to be worked on.
That's a motion to
send back to committee.
So what do you want to do?
I would like to refer it back to committee.
So, and you're still seconding, Dan? Okay.
Can I call the question?
I have a comment.
You actually can't once he's done that.
Exactly. That's why I'm saying I have a comment. So if she calls his question, if she's recognizing that.
Sure, did not rule on that.
So?
Let me see. I have a line of people here. I had Mike Sigler in line.
I'd be happy with sending it back to committee, because as it stands now, I wouldn't vote for it. I mean, the governor's already acted on this. And I would remind people, too, that just legislatively, once you do something legislatively, it takes an act of legislation to actually undo it. And it seems, from everything I've heard about COVID-19 right now, this is changing every 15 minutes. Yeah, I don't really think it's a wise idea to lock something down until next January, when the legislature will reconvene, they'll probably be doing emergency sessions. Anyway, that's my two cents on it. So if we want to send it back to committee, I'm fine with it.
All right, so the motion on the table right now is to refer it back to committee. Please speak to the motion on the table. Is that what you're doing, Shauna?
Yes.
I would ask that we not move it back to committee based on the fact that this is actually very time sensitive. I think that if we took out the resolves, we would have a much different resolution.
So is somebody moving an amendment to... Can we do that?
No.
This wasn't an amendment. This was just, this was a whole different. It wasn't an amendment. Never mind.
I would move to amend it after, if we'd fail to table it, I would move an amendment.
Okay. Any other comments on the motion to refer back to committee? Let's take a vote on that motion. Motion to refer back to committee. Roll call. Give us a second. We're getting situated up here.
Glenn Morey?
No.
Martha Robertson?
No.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
No.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
No.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
No.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
No.
Eight ayes, six noes.
Okay. Motion carries to send it back to a committee for some massaging. I'm not going to editorialize. Thank you for your vote on that.
And that is the end of my report.
Thank you very much, Anna, and thank you for your attempt to bring that.
Sure.
No individual member file resolutions. Can we take the minutes of the previous meeting? Moved by Deborah, seconded by Shauna. Any corrections, amendments, anything? Don't do it. Okay. Let's have a roll call on the minutes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson? Martha Robertson?
On the minutes.
I'm sorry. What are we voting on? The minutes?
The minutes.
We're voting on the chair of the legislature.
Well, I can't hear you.
We're voting on the minutes, Martha.
Good one.
She voted yes. Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
No.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Absolutely.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes, please.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, one no.
So before I announce that, I do have a quick question. I'm not going to announce that. Henry, did you seriously have something you wanted to amend in the minutes?
No.
Oh, okay. All right, so that carries?
Yes.
13 to 1. Any unfinished business? No? Motion to adjourn?
Yes.
Moved by Amanda, seconded by Henry. Everybody in favor of adjourning?
Aye.
On the phone? Are you in favor of adjourning?
Thank you.
Thank you. We are adjourned.
Good night, Amanda.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks to Greg and everybody else for the IT stuff.
Have a good night. Have a good night, Jonathan.